Earth explorers, welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than we thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Arc of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived a disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. Welcome to X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. My AccuWindow forecast says it's about 25 degrees outside here in eastern Washington State. We will have an archive on for the next 2 weeks because I'm going to take a little break for Christmas. And then we'll be back on the 6th of January. The solar physics community is abuzz this week. No, there haven't been any great eruptions or solar storms. The source of the excitement is a modest knot of magnetism that popped up on the sun, possibly heralding the start of a new solar cycle. It could be starting right now. New solar cycles always begin with a high-latitude reverse polarity sunspot, explains Hathaway, one of the solar scientists. Reverse polarity means a sunspot with opposite magnetic polarity compared to sunspots from the previous solar cycle. High latitude refers to the sun's grid of latitude and longitude. Old cycle sunspots congregate near the sun's equator, like the one we see now. New cycle sunspots appear higher, around 25 or 30 degrees latitude. The region that appeared on December 11th fits both of these criteria. It is high latitude, 24 degrees north, and magnetically reversed. Just one problem. There's no sunspot. So far, the region is just a bright knot of magnetic fields. If, however, these fields coalesce into a dark sunspot, scientists are ready to announce that solar cycle 24 has officially begun. Many forecasters believe solar cycle 24 will be big and intense, peaking in 2011, or you guessed it, 2012. The cycle to come could have significant impacts on telecommunications, air traffic, power grids, and GPS systems. And don't forget the Northern Lights. In this age of satellites and cell phones, the next solar cycle could make itself felt as never before. The solar wind tonight is a medium 378.6 kilometers per second, but the protons per cubic centimeter are up to 7.4. Sunspot 978 is huge and breaking up, so get out your coronoscopes and take a look before it heads over the limb of the sun. The next good chance for an aurora sighting will be on the 17th or 18th in the northern latitudes. Last week on X Squared Radio, we had the former senior physicist and department head for the Michelson Interferometer Spectrometer and the current director of research for the Meru Foundation, Stanley Tenen. Go back and listen to that one when you get a chance. This week, we have the current master physicist on the subject of time travel. In fact, he may have been able to solve some of the key problems with making a time machine. He is currently a professor of physics at University of Connecticut. Call up your friends and tell them X Squared Radio is live right now. We're about to go beyond your imagination. Please welcome with me Ronald Mallett. How are you, Ronald?
Hi. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, boy. It's a pleasure to be with you, too. I just finished your book, Time Traveler, and what a remarkable book. It's a very easy read. Should take you, two or three hours to read this book. But be prepared, get your pen out, because there's a lot of neat stuff to underline and write in the margins. So I was fascinated, just completely fascinated with the book. It's always been my favorite book and movie theme, time travel. And I guess it was yours, too.
Yes, it was. As a matter of fact, it played a key role. The movies and the book, science fiction books, played a key role in it. And one of the reasons why I became interested in the subject was a very personal one. My father, he was the center of my life. I mean, he was just a wonderful person. And he was a television technician, television repairman. And he died of a massive heart attack when he was only 33 years old.
Oh, my God.
And I was 10. And it completely destroyed my world. But one of the things that I love to do is to read science fiction, and about a year after he died, when I was about 11, I came across H.G. Wells' book, The Time Machine, and that turned things completely around for me because it gave me hope. I thought if I could build a time machine, then I could see him again and maybe save his life. So that became my inspiration. That became my obsession, I should say, to try to build a time machine. And about a year after that, when I was 12, I came across a popular book about Einstein, and it said that the great genius Einstein had said that time was not something that was fixed, but time could be changed. So that became my next obsession, was to try to understand everything that Einstein had to say. Now, of course, that required a considerable amount of more I had to understand about math and science, but the thing is that in Einstein's work, time travel is definitely possible.
Well, sure. What kid in school has not been exposed to E is equal to MC squared? That looks simple enough, doesn't it?
Well, that equation looks simple enough, but the thing is that most people don't realize that equation actually holds the key for the possibility of traveling through time. Most people think of the equation in terms of the atomic bomb, you know, the E being the energy and the M being mass and C being the square of light, so that if you multiply that huge number, the speed of light squared times a little bit of mass, then you get an enormous amount of energy. But what they don't realize is the reason that equation exists is because of the fact that space and time are connected to each other. And because they are connected to each other, Einstein showed that motion through space allows time to slow down, to actually change as a result of motion. So that is the link that allows for time travel into the future, is the faster that you move, the more time will slow down. And since your heart is a clock, this means that your heart rate, your metabolism, all of these things slow down if you're moving quickly enough. So you don't age as much when you're traveling very quickly as someone who is not moving at all. So this allows you to reach the future younger than everyone else if you're going fast enough.
Well, so if we have, say we have triplets that grow into young men, one lives on a high mountain and one lives in a deep valley on the earth, and each one's wearing a synchronized wristwatch, whose watch will run slower?
Okay, well, that's Einstein's other theory, his general theory of relativity, which has to do with the fact that gravity can affect time. And according to Einstein, the stronger gravity is, the more a clock will slow down. So that means that someone that's at the bottom of the mountain, their clock will be running slower than someone that's at the middle of the mountain, and someone at the top of the mountain, their clock will be running faster than all of the other clocks. So the closer you are to the center of the earth, where gravity is stronger, the more time will slow down for you. And this really has everyday consequences. The GPS satellites, the clock, they have clocks on board. And since those clocks are so far away from the earth, those clocks are actually running at a rate that's faster than the clocks here on the earth. And if this has to be taken into account in calibrating the clocks, or we wouldn't be able to find our correct position here on the earth. So this effect of Einstein that gravity slowing time down has very practical consequences.
That's interesting.
And so these triplets would be, the one who's at the bottom would be aging more slowly than the one at the middle, and he would be aging even slower than the one that was at the top of the mountain.
Wow, that's interesting. So if the third boy of this triplet series were to, say, get into an Einsteinian elevator and go down into the center of the earth, what would happen to his age?
Well, you got to remember, when I say that the earth, I'm talking about, you have to, it has the mass. Because as long as you're above the surface of the earth, all of the mass acts as though it's concentrated at the center.
Right.
But once you start moving into the earth, then the mass above you doesn't contribute in the same way. So you can't increase it by just simply going towards the center of the earth. So what I'm talking about is from surface level. Okay, so that's where you want to measure it from. So it would be from that level would be the strongest point. And then it would get weaker and weaker and weaker, the gravity, as you got to higher and higher elevations. But if you wanted to really slow time down, what you would want to do is to get next to a much more massive body. For example, if you got close to a black hole, as you know, is a star that has collapsed to a point where the light that tries to escape from the star all gets pulled back to the star. So since the gravity is pulling all of the light back to the star, if you're standing outside of the star, since all the light is being pulled back, you don't see anything there. That's a black hole. So a black hole, but that means that the gravity around the black hole is so strong, so much stronger than it is here on Earth, that if you take a clock and go close to a black hole, time would come to nearly a halt when you got near the surface of the black hole. You would actually find that your clock would run so slow compared to someone else who's away from the black hole that if you got close enough to a black hole, maybe only hours are passing for you, but hundreds of years could be passing for everyone else that's away from the black hole. So that would be one way of slowing time down to nearly a halt. Now, that's if you get close enough to a black hole.
To live to tell about it.
Well, right, if you don't go across to the other side of the black hole, if you go to the other side, then you're in trouble because the tidal forces will start pulling you apart because, you know, even here on the surface of the earth, when you're standing on the ground, since your feet are closer to the center of the earth than your head, that means the gravity is pulling on your feet more than it's pulling on your head, but you don't notice it that much. But if you go on the other side of a black hole, the gravity on your feet is so much greater than the gravity on your head that as you're moving towards the center of the black hole, you would feel tidal forces across your body, gravitational tidal forces that would accelerate your feet much faster than your head, and that would rip you apart as you were going towards it. And then, of course, all of your molecules would start experiencing this and would get ripped into your atoms, and so eventually you would just be a soup of energy falling towards the center of the black hole. So you want to stay at the edge of a black hole. You don't want to cross over to the other side. But as long as you stay near the edge, you would be okay.
All right, so we'll try to do that. But I think that's kind of what the moon does to the Earth as well. The moon's gravity isn't as intense as a black hole, but it does stretch and squeeze the oceans of the Earth.
So oh, absolutely.
When we talk about tidal gravity, that's what we're talking about, is that the oceans are actually being moved around by the gravitational field of the moon.
That's right. That's right. It's the same sort of forces that the moon produces on the oceans of the Earth. And a black hole, as you were moving towards that, would produce those kind of forces on you. And it would squeeze you and stretch you to a point of ripping you apart if you got too close.
Okay. All right. Well, that's how gravity affects time. How does speed through space affect time?
Well, with speed, according to Einstein, that's connected with his special theory of relativity, mm-hmm. The faster a clock moves, the more time will slow down. So if you're on, and in fact, an experiment, now the thing is that there was an experiment to show this with human beings and with ordinary clocks. This was done in the 1970s, and most people aren't aware of it. It was called the Heifel-Keating experiment. And two atomic clocks, one was kept stationary at the Naval Observatory. The other atomic clock was put on an ordinary passenger jet. And the two clocks are calibrated with each other initially. And the clock that was on the passenger jet was flown around the world close to the speed of sound. When they brought the passenger jet back, they found that when they compared the clock that had been on the passenger jet, then just exactly as Einstein had predicted, time had slowed down for the clock on the passenger jet. That is to say, it had lost time compared to the clock that had been stationary at the Naval Observatory. This means that the scientists who were on board actually aged less than those scientists who were on the ground. Now, the fact that the passenger jet was only going at the speed of sound, the effect was only fractions of a second, but it was completely measurable. And what Einstein said is that the faster you go, the more this effect will happen. So whenever we have rockets that are going very, very fast, this effect becomes, you know, quite noticeable. And eventually, when we get rockets that can go close to the speed of light, we won't be able to go faster than the speed of light, but when we get rockets that can go close to the speed of light, we'll see this effect so dramatically that for an astronaut that's going out into space, if they're going close to the speed of light, for them, it may only appear as though only a few years has passed. But if they're going fast enough, when they come back, they may find that decades have passed. That's Einstein's special theory of relativity. So the way to demarcate the two different theories is that the special theory of relativity has to do with speed. And it says that the faster a clock moves, the more time slows down. Einstein's general theory of relativity has to do with gravity. And it says that the stronger gravity is, the more time will slow down. And my research is based on using Einstein's general theory of relativity. In other words, using the effect of gravity on time in order to affect clocks.
Cool.
And that's where I made my breakthrough that I mentioned in my book, Time Traveler.
Right. And we are going to talk about the time machine toward the end of the program, halfway through the second hour. But I want to try to lay some groundwork because otherwise, we're going to lose about 12 million listeners that are sitting out there. I do want to let you know out there, Earth Explorers, that you can call in. So we have a toll-free number. This works in the U.S. and Canada, 888-228-4494. And we have a second toll-free number in Canada. That's 877-489-6350. And if you have a cell phone and you're out there, you're in Australia or in Ireland and you want to reach us, you can reach us at 530-776-5154 or 530-776-5185. And if you're using Skype, you can reach us at BBS Radio. If you're using PalTalk, you can reach us at BBSRadio_com. And don't forget that you can always reach us on AOL Instant Messenger. My handle is Vision Officer, so just search for that. You'll find me. and we'll take questions every way that we can get them tonight. My guest tonight is Ronald Mallett, and he is the author of a book called Time Traveler. And this is kind of where I always get lost in this discussion, because one of the things that baffles, say, police at the scene of a car accident during periods of poor visibility is how fast the drivers travel. They say this is because the driver has no perspective with his surroundings. He can't see outside the windows. So he has no sensation of speed. Hence, he overdrives the conditions and he crashes. Well, aren't bodies in space a little like that too? I mean, how do we know when we're going fast in space?
That's an excellent question. The thing is that we don't know. The only way that we can tell is by referencing another object. In fact, that's the whole notion of relativity. It doesn't matter whether we're moving at 10 miles an hour or 10,000 miles an hour. We would not be able to tell the difference. In fact, if you're in a rocket and you're not looking outside, let's suppose the rocket doesn't have a windows or, you know, you're completely inside. There's nothing that you can do inside the rocket that will tell you how fast you're moving. So if you're moving, as I said, you could be moving at 10 miles an hour, you could be moving at 10,000 miles an hour, or you could be moving at, close to a million miles an hour. You would still not know how fast you're moving as long as you're in a rocket. You would have to have another reference frame. So you would have to look outside, and as you were passing another object, you could use that as a reference. But that's the only way that you're going to be able to tell. Now, the thing is that you can tell when your speed has changed. That is to say that if you're going from 10 miles an hour to 20 miles an hour, you can tell when you're accelerating up to that speed. But once you're at that speed, there's no way that you can know how fast you're going. So a person who is traveling very fast won't feel the effect of it.
Right. I had a person ask me a question. I think I was in the third or fourth grade, and they asked me, how would you do space travel? And I said, well, I'd probably accelerate at about 1G for about, 6 or 7 weeks. And then I'd turn the spacecraft around, and I'd decelerate at 1G for about 6 or 7 weeks, and then I'd be someplace far out in space. So there would be a sort of artificial gravity for acceleration.
That's right. Yeah, and that would be the way in which you could do it. If you kept up a steady acceleration, then your speed would be constantly increasing as long as you're doing that. And that would allow you to go as fast as you want up to the speed of light. As I said, you would not be able to exceed that. And the light barrier is not like the sound barrier. Sometimes people think that isn't that just a technical problem that, we'll be able to break the light barrier the way we can break the sound barrier, but no, it actually is not possible, mainly because of the same reason that we have that famous equation E=mc². And that is something that people don't realize, that equation tells you why you can't go faster than the speed of light. And it turns out that the equation usually, the E, as I said, stands for energy, and the M stands for mass. And people usually think of the equation in terms of going from a little bit of mass to a huge amount of energy. But you can read the equation the other way, too. That is to say that a large amount of energy will actually be converted into mass. So the equation goes both ways. And that's the problem, because as you are accelerating the rocket and giving it energy, some of that energy goes into the mass of the rocket, and it makes the rocket a little bit more heavy, if you want to think of it that way, a little more massive. So that means it's a little harder to give it more energy. So as you're trying to increase the speed, the mass of the object that you're trying to increase the speed, its mass goes up. Its mass actually gets greater, gets more massive, so it becomes harder. So when you try to get it to go at the speed of light, what you would find is that you would need an infinite amount of energy in order to get it to go at the speed of light. So that's the reason why you can't break the light barrier.
Well, I have some pretty astute listeners, and one brought to my attention that there are actually four terms in that equation, E=mc². C is actually distance over time, right? 186,000 miles over a second.
But right.
We just established that the second changes. The second is not stable.
Well, yeah, but no, but you have to take the combination in the case of light. And this is actually very, very important, because they're right if you can separate it out, but you can't. When you're talking about the speed of light, you have to keep that as a whole entity, because the speed of light is unlike any other speed. That is to say that let me give you a simple example.
Okay.
Suppose that, you know, you and I were in the same room, and I tossed a baseball at you,
mm-hmm.
Okay? The baseball is going to be coming at you at a certain speed. Let's suppose that it's coming at you. Let's say I'm giving you a slow pitch. So let's say it's coming at you at about 10 miles per hour. Okay? Now, let's suppose that I run towards you. Okay? Now, if I run towards you, let's suppose that I'm a good runner. Let's suppose that I can run towards you at 5 miles an hour? Okay?
Okay.
Well, how fast is that ball going to be coming towards you? The ball's going to be coming at you with the 10 miles an hour that I'm tossing it plus the 5 miles an hour that I'm running towards you. So the ball's going to be coming at you at 15 miles an hour, right?
Okay, yes.
Okay? All right. Now, let's go back to light. And here is the strange thing, because you can think of light as being made up of little particles that are called photons. And these photons are coming very fast at 186,000 miles per second. But nevertheless, the speed they're coming at is a finite speed. Now, suppose that I have a flashlight and I'm turning the flashlight onto you. So these photons are coming at you, okay, at the speed of light.
Right.
Now, suppose that I run towards you with the flashlight. Now, what you would expect is, and this is what, the reason why I'm saying this is what you would expect is because physicists in the 19th century actually did expect this. Just like the baseball, okay, if I'm running towards you with the baseball is going to be coming at you faster than if I'm standing still and tossing it to you. If I'm holding a flashlight and shining it towards you and I'm standing still, the photons are going to be coming at you at the speed of light. Now, if I'm running towards you with the flashlight, you would expect that the photons are going to now be coming at you at the speed of light plus the speed that I'm running towards you, just like the baseball. That's what everyone expected. What they found to their complete surprise was that the photons were still coming at you at the speed of light. In other words, it was as though you were standing still, even though you knew that you were moving. And think about this, how weird this would be. This would be this, like when I was throwing the baseball at you at 10 miles per hour, and if I was running towards you and the baseball was still coming at you, at 10 miles an hour. In other words, that is not what we would expect and not what we would think that we would see. And that is what people thought would happen with photons, with particles of light, is that they would be coming at you faster if you're running towards a person. This was something that they couldn't explain. I mean, they did not know, why is it that light wasn't changing? And that's where Einstein came on the scene. Einstein said that the only way that the speed of light can be the same no matter whether you're standing still or you're moving, or the light is moving towards you. The only way that can happen is that something must be happening to the time that we're using to measure the speed of light. That's the only way that can happen. So what Einstein said is that if the speed of light is slowing down, then that will compensate for the fact that the speed of light is the same no matter whether the flashlight is at rest or it's moving towards you. So what Einstein said is that time has to slow down. Time has to change in order for the speed of light to stay the same. So that's the reason why that in that equation equals mc squared, that speed in there, c, does not change. It is a constant. But the only way that it can stay constant is that time has to change,
right,
and space, okay?
Right.
So that's the reason.
And the one thing that we started noticing when we looked at further out into space is that because the speed of light was constant, what did happen is as bodies that emitted light were passing toward us, It compressed the wavelength of the light.
That's right.
And shifted.
That's right.
And that
that's
was
right.
another proof.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, that's a very important one. That's as you mentioned. That's the as the, if this light source is coming towards us, and it's compressing it, the light, the color of the light becomes bluer. So that's actually called blue shift. And if the light source is moving away from us, the light waves sort of expand, and the color tends to come red, and that's called the red shift. And in fact, that's a very important way in which we're able to talk about the speed of, and know the direction that objects are moving either towards us or away from us, stars, that is to say, in space. Because if they're moving away from us, then the light should become redder, or if they're moving towards us, the light should become bluer. And that was, in fact, one of the first ways in which we knew that we were living in an expanding universe, is because when we looked around at all of the galaxies around us, we noticed that, in general, the galaxies, no matter what direction we were looking, the light from them was tending to become redder. And that allowed us to deduce the fact that the galaxies are moving away from us. And if they're moving away from us in every direction, that means at one time they were closer. So that means that we're in an expanding universe where everything is actually moving away from us.
Well, it doesn't necessarily mean that we, planet Earth, were at the center of this big explosion. But
No, because the thing is that the way in which it's pictured, in fact, and it's a pretty accurate representation, is to imagine how you can think of this expanding universe is if you think, suppose that you have a balloon, a black balloon, and you think of that black balloon as representing space, and suppose that when you put little white dots all over the balloon, and those little white dots represent different galaxies. Now, one of those galaxies would be the Milky Way, which is the galaxy we live in. Another galaxy would be the Andromeda Galaxy, for example. Now, the thing is that if, as you blow this balloon up, all of these white dots on the surface of the balloon are going to be moving away from each other. But no matter what dot you're on, all the dots around you are going to be moving away. So if you're in our Milky Way galaxy, you're going to see all the galaxies moving away from us. But if you happen to be on the Andromeda galaxy, you're going to see all of the galaxies moving away from it. So it's very much like the dots on the surface of the balloon, that as you blow the balloon up, the balloon, the expansion of the balloon represents space expanding. But every dot, all the other dots around it will be moving away from it. So that's the, yes. So it's nothing special about the fact that the galaxies are moving away from us. It's just that we're looking at it from that particular dot. But if we were to move to another point on the surface of the balloon, we would see all of the dots moving away from us, including our galaxy.
One of my acquaintances, physicist Nassim Haramein, and I believe you're describing De Sitter space. I think De Sitter was the one that came up with the idea of the balloon. But
yeah, that's right.
He says, who's the guy that's blowing the balloon up?
Well, that gets into theological questions that we don't need to go into here.
That's funny.
Yeah.
So, and this was a little bit of consternation for our friend Einstein, right?
Well, the thing is that it was only because of his preconception. I mean, he was a person of his time, and he, like other astronomers and physicists, thought that the universe was eternal and unchanging. I mean, that was their perception. I mean, if you look out into the sky, it doesn't look like things are moving away from us. I mean, you know, there's what's known as a peculiar motion, that is to say, motion of objects one way or the other, but there's no general, it doesn't appear as though there's any general motion away from us. So according to, so Einstein, and this, as I said, was something that was anchored in his own philosophical prejudices, which wasn't just his, it was shared by the people of the time, which was that the universe is always unchanging. So when he first developed his gravitational theory, he put in a special term into it that's called, you might call it the cosmic fudge factor, but it was a term that's called the cosmological constant by physicists now. And what that whole purpose of that term was to keep the universe from expanding. So whenever Hubble realized that by observation that the universe was expanding by looking at the redshift of the galaxies, Einstein said that putting in the cosmological constant was one of the biggest blunders in his life. And it turns out that he was actually wrong even about that, because it turns out that even with the cosmological constant in there, you can actually show that Einstein's theory leads to expanding universes, and that's what De Sitter did. So Einstein was wrong about it being a blunder, but he was also wrong about it keeping the universe from changing. So even his great mistake was a great advance.
Are all the galaxies moving apart from one another, or are there galaxies that are colliding with one another?
Well, the thing is that's what I meant by what's called peculiar motion. That is to say that gravity attracts, and if there's galaxies and clusters of galaxies, which will, if they're close enough, will be attracting. But if you look at space as a whole, not just over some particular region, but space as a whole, what you find is that the galaxies as a whole are tending to move away from us. But local gravitational attraction will cause certain galaxies to get into orbit and to collide and to move around each other. But generally speaking, the galaxies are moving away from each other.
Well, are there galaxies that are moving apart so fast that their light will never be seen by one another?
Yeah, well, that's because of the fact that, remember, using the balloon analogy again, if you're standing at one particular dot and you look out, you'll find that the dots that are further away from you are moving faster from you. And that is to say that so, and there will eventually be dots that are moving over the horizon that you're going to be able to see anymore, because they're like on the other side of the balloon. And if you look at that in terms of here on in our galaxy with respect to other galaxies, as the galaxies begin to move fast enough, as you look out in the space, you find that they're moving faster and faster and faster. There will be a point in which you no longer can see the galaxy. It will have moved over the horizon, so to speak. So, yeah, there will be, and that is an effect. That's one of the things that Hubble found, was that the further a galaxy is away from us, the faster it's moving. And there will eventually be a horizon beyond which we won't be able to see that. And that would represent, essentially, if you went back in time, you could consider that to be the beginning of time.
One of my listeners wants to apply Schrodinger logic and say that the galaxy doesn't exist because we have not observed it. Who was it? I can't remember who it was that protested this idea by jabbing with, "Do you mean the moon exists because a mouse looked at it?"
Yeah, I mean, that's sort of a mixture of some ideas that are close to quantum theory, but it's not really the way in which the objects exist independent of us. Even in quantum theory, the objects exist independent of it. What quantum theory is referring to is properties associated with an object that are associated with the experiment that you're performing on it. In other words, an electron exists independent of whether you're looking at it or not, but aspects of the electron, whether the electron is behaving as a particle or whether the electron is behaving as a wave, does depend on the experimental apparatus that you have. So you're not able to say that it's definitely either a particle or a wave. But it is an electron, whether or not, you know, it's a particle or a wave. You see what I'm saying? In other words, the electron exists, but it's just its properties are dependent on the observation.
So are we talking about the observation effect?
Right. We're talking about the observation effect. And this particular listener was talking, if they're applying sort of, they used the name Schrodinger, and of course Schrodinger was the physicists who developed the Schrodinger equation, which describes initially to describe the wave behavior of the electron. And ultimately, when quantum mechanics was developed, we found that the observational properties of a system were something that were dependent on the experimental situation in which we were observing the system. But the system is there. Whether or not we're observing it, but those properties that are associated with the system depend on the experimental. So the galaxy exists independent of whether we are observing it or not, but one could say that we're not aware of what particular properties it might have until we observe it, but it exists whether we observe it or not.
Yeah, I believe that. I mean, it exists whether we notice it or not. However, it is bandied about in now even mainstream scientific circles that observation on purpose does seem to affect the very thing we're trying to measure. So in a sense, we're having an effect on the universe.
Well, yeah, I mean, but the thing is that once again, that's because of the fact that properties emerge because of the experiment that we're setting up to see those properties. I mean, in other words, once again, as I said, when we're talking about an electron, it depends on whether or not the experimental setup that we have, we're looking for properties that are associated with its wave properties or properties that are associated with its particles properties. So we are, in a sense, calling up those properties by the experiment in which we said. This is the point. When people talk about observation, they forget that observation really is an experiment. Even when you're looking at something in the real world, it's light that's coming in and hitting your retina. That's actually an experiment in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a controlled experiment in the sense that you do in the laboratory, but nevertheless it's an experiment. So sometimes it's a bit of a misnomer because every observation is an experiment. And it's the experiment that you set up that causes certain properties of the system to emerge. So yes, in that sense, our observing the system does affect it and bring those properties about because we have set up an experiment that causes those properties to emerge.
When you spent all your time in the library as a youth and you were fascinated with this subject and sort of driven by the passion to get back to observe or send a message to your dad, you ran across several equations that looked beautiful but baffled you. Did you do what the rest of us do, have an incredible urge to put the book down, or did you go out and try to learn the math so that you could understand the beauty of the mathematical statement?
Well, that's a good point because the very first of those equations that you were talking about, which I encountered when I was 12 by reading this popular book on Einstein, was called The Universe and Dr. Einstein. And the thing is, it was the so-called Lorentz equation about time. In other words, the equation actually described how time is changed, how time slows down for a moving clock. But I couldn't understand the equation because I hadn't had algebra. I mean, I didn't even know. I mean, the only thing that that I could know is that the text said that this is what the equation said, but I didn't know, I couldn't understand the equation, but I was so obsessed with understanding this equation because it seemed to me that this equation would be part of the key to understanding time travel, that I would just write it down like someone who was drawing, mimicking the paintings of masters. I mean, I would just scribble it. I would just write it down on everywhere. It became like a holy script to me, even though I didn't understand anything about it, and it might have been hieroglyphics as far as I was concerned, but I knew that the key was there and that someday I would eventually learn it. So my quest was to try to learn the math that would be necessary to do that. And eventually I found that, you know, that by learning algebra, I could do that. But that's why I was driven. I was driven because I had a purpose. I wanted to do it. And that is what drove me, is to get to the root of this equation, because then I would know how to do it. So, no, I didn't put it down, but I certainly didn't understand it immediately. And it took me time.
I know a lot of people look at mathematics and this looks like hieroglyphics. I mean, the Lorentz equation, as far as math goes, is pretty simple. It's just
That's right.
Really not that, but it does show you the relationship between things, and you can see that even without working the mathematics. But here's what fascinates me when I study guys like Riemann or Tesla or these guys, is they, in their own memoirs or even in biographies that people do about them, they often comment about epiphanies that they have in dream states. I mean, obviously, Lorentz, you know, did not learn this from his Dutch math teacher. He got to the end of known math and tried to imagine a relationship about time. And it it inspired him to put terms together in this kind of relationship, which we call the Lorentz equation. And it's inspired other mathematicians who then stand on his shoulders and go on to the next thing. Did you have kind of a dream epiphany? Many people call it a download, where you kind of get pure information, a breakthrough after banging your head into the slide rule for a number of years?
Well, that actually happened to me when I was in college. I should mention that when my father died, the family we were extremely poor. I mean, we were in a state of poverty. And my mother worked as a maid, and it was a very, very difficult time. I should mention at the time that we were growing up, I'm African American, and it was very hard on a number of different levels for the family. And college was not something that was immediately in my future. So I went into the service, used the GI Bill by going into the Air Force. This was during the Vietnam War era, and eventually I went to Penn State.
I did the same thing. Go on.
It's a great way of doing it. And so by using the GI Bill, I was able to go to Penn State, and that's where I got my bachelor's, master's, and PhD. And while I was working on my thesis for my PhD, that is one of the times that it clearly happened to me. I had been working on this project to try to understand how quantum mechanics could be described in terms of the expanding universe of De Sitter. And I had been, and especially how you could look at the process of time reversal. That was one of the things I was interested in, was trying to look at that process of time reversal in terms of an expanding universe. And I had been working on it and working on it and working on it. And there is what's known in relativity as a four-dimensional approach that's used. That is to say that the three dimensions of space, you know, length, height, and width, are the three dimensions, and the fourth dimension is time. That's the major aspect of the special theory of relativity, is the four dimensions of space and time. And I was trying to figure out how to describe this process, and it seemed like I was going nowhere. No matter what I took to my thesis advisor, he would say, you know, look, this looks close, but it's just not right. And I remember one time feeling one afternoon, I felt very, very discouraged. And I came home and I laid down on my couch. And when I went to sleep, I had this vision just floated in my head, these symbols. And the symbols were that if I took this four-dimensional approach and I combined it with a fifth dimension describing the De Sitter universe, then that would be the key. And I woke up and I knew that was it. I mean, even without having to go to my thesis advisor, I knew that by using the ordinary four dimensions of space and time and combining them with the fifth dimension representing De Sitter space, that would do it. And it was. I mean, you know, and when I took it to him, he said, yes, that's it. I mean, it was incredible. I mean, I still remember it to this day, that going from that four-dimensional, five-dimensional approach was the key. And it happened while I was in a dream state. And it's funny because later, after I got my PhD, I went looking for a job, and it was hard to find university positions. Eventually, I found an industry position as a scientist at United Technologies. And when I went for my interview, the interview I thought seemed to go pretty well. The person who interviewed me, we've become close friends. His name is Jerry Peterson. But he told me many, many years later that the reason why he decided to hire me was not all of the other things, the fact that I published. And he said he thought those were all good things, but he said it was when I told him about how it was that I had made my breakthrough in my thesis. In a dream, he said that's when he decided he was going to hire me, you know, as a scientist there. But it was a marvelous thing, and it was very, very vivid.
Well, anybody that's done postgraduate work, you're going to end up doing, you know, teaching assistant, which is basically unpaid labor. But you get a good experience from it, and the thing that you realize is that very soon you're going to reach out to an area that you've never had any experience in, and you're going to get so frustrated that you Well, you cry. I mean, there is crying in mathematics.
Right.
And I can tell you that right after you dry your tears up, that's when you're going to get your answer. Because something happens in the human mind when you get to the end of everything that you've been taught and you still can't figure it out. When you reach industry, they're always doing something that's never been done before. You don't have a textbook to go to. There's no instruction manual. You have to create. And that's why maybe this dream ability, this ability to reach into all of the known that you have and find something unknown, that's a real talent.
Yeah. Well, the unconscious, Brooks, it's really that, you know. I mean, I think we tap the unconscious. And the thing is that, but it has to be, it is sometimes people, what people don't realize is that it has to be prepared, however. I mean, you have to have done all of that other work. In other words, you have to have built up that reservoir. And it's that that the unconscious is using. It's not just coming out of nowhere.
Oh, that's right. You can't just sit around and dream your PhD. You will.
That's right.
Oh my goodness. So tell us just a little bit about your experience at United Technologies, because it's going to lay the groundwork for what we're going to cover in our second and third hours tonight with Ronald Mallett. And his book is called Time Traveler, and I think you have a website, right? It's ronaldmallett.com.
Well, no, it's www.physics.UConn, and that's UConn.edu. And if they go to that website and click on faculty and click on my name, that'll bring them to my homepage. www.physics.UConn.edu.
I've got it. I think I remember that's how I found you in the first place, because I'm always looking for physicists out there that are doing breakthroughs, and certainly time travel is one of them. I want to let you know, in case you're new to the program, this is a three-hour program, and we are broadcasting, actually netcasting, on the BBS Radio Network and the Steel Eye Radio Network, and we appreciate our producers. In our next hour, we're going to cover time paradoxes, and then we're going to crack this experiment over. But tell us a little bit about your experience at United. What did they want you to do?
Right. Well, it was entirely different from what I had been doing my PhD under. My PhD was in relativistic cosmology. What that means is that applies relativity to the structure of the universe. And in particular, as I mentioned, I was looking at De Sitter space and looking how time is affected by De Sitter space. But the work that they wanted me to do at United Technologies was very practical. The division that I was in, which was the research center, essentially that division contracted us out to other divisions of United Technologies. One of United Technologies' biggest subdivisions, which most people probably heard about, is Pratt & Whitney. Pratt & Whitney, of course, is the major manufacturer of commercial and military aircraft engines. And they wanted me, at the time, what they were trying to do was to use lasers to drill holes in turbine blades. That was not a process that had been developed. They had the other process, and they wanted to use lasers to do that. And so they asked me to do theoretical support work. That is to say that I was supposed to come up with equations that would describe what would happen if you use laser beams of certain intensities, and if they, you know, shot those lasers at metals of particular types or alloys that Pratt & Whitney were interested in, could they calculate how fast the drilling process would go. So that's what I was contracted for, and I had no real knowledge. I mean, I just had a small knowledge of what lasers were all about at that particular point. But one of the points about the PhD is the fact that you're trained to do research. So they gave me the space that I needed to learn about lasers. And that turned out to actually be something at the time. It was interesting enough, but at the time it seemed to me rather remote from what I was going to ultimately be trying to do. But as you point out, that turns out to have been an extremely important turning point. I was only in industry for 2 years, and And I did, in fact, find the equations that were necessary to use the laser for that process, and they did. Now it is a process that's online at United Technologies. They actually routinely use lasers to drill holes in turbine blades.
I don't know what we do without laser cutting. I mean, as I said off the air, I'm a commercial scientist, and I use. And by the way, those of you that are thinking about, maybe I should study physics, but how do I get a job and all that? Don't worry about that, because the skills and the thinking processes that you learn to get that degree in physics will apply everywhere, in manufacturing.
Absolutely.
Of all kinds. So don't be afraid of that. One of the scariest things for us when we hire new engineers is that they don't have enough theory background to know how to do things from scratch. They just know the practical stuff. And we need you to have the theoretical skills, so don't be afraid to get that master's or PhD in physics. It'll be very, very helpful for the universe.
Yes. Thank you for pointing that out. And that is something that was one of the things that made the physicists useful to the company, was the fact that they had such a general broad background that they could cover a range of problems. They weren't just concentrating on one particular area. They were able to find to go in at the theoretical basis of all of the engineering sciences. And in fact, physics lies at the base of all of the engineering sciences.
Sure. And then, the PLC, that's a programmable logic controller, can take these equations and make machines that follow those equations by those unknowns, by those variables, and create all kinds of robotics and surgical tools, and using single or even fractions of wavelengths to do things in all kinds of industries. So that's just a little bit to inspire you to stay the course, and might want to pass up those weekly parties and save a few brain cells, because you're going to need them.
Yes.
to have these
truly
dreams, right? You're going to need them to have these dreams to get the answers. All right.
Well, and it's worth it.
We are going to take about a 4.5-minute break here. It's the top of the hour. My guest is Dr. Ronald Mallett. He is the author of Time Traveler. Real quick, Ronald, tell us this hour how they can get their hands on this book.
Right. The book can be most easily gotten through Amazon.com. It's also available at Borders and Barnes & Noble and other bookstores, but the easiest way is through Amazon.com.
Excellent. All right. We will be back with more in about 4.5 minutes. Don't go away, my friends. There is a lot more to come. You're really going to enjoy it. We're going to talk about time paradoxes and Dr. Ronald Mallett's time machine. So don't go away. We'll be back after these messages with more X Squared Radio. Foundations of Religion and Science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. If you have survived a disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared.
Have you ever thought about owning a telescope? I mean a really good telescope. Well, at the Discovery Store, you can find the world's best telescopes at great discounts and free shipping. They've come a long way, you know. Most of the comets discovered in the last 50 years were found by amateurs. There is no better way to view the sun than with a coronoscope. Trust me, you will be captivated if you ever get to watch the sun through one of these units. Who knows? You might just save the planet. So plan a trip to the Discovery Store at X Squared Radio.
This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. Welcome back, Earth Explorers, to X Squared Radio. We missed you, even though you've only been gone for a few minutes. We're coming to you live from Eastern Washington State, where it's chilly outside. Also wanted to give you a little bit of news. Despite funding uncertainty, NASA is on track to return humans to the moon by 2020 and set up a lunar outpost to serve as a springboard to explore Mars, officials said Monday. Our job is to build towns on the moon and eventually put tire prints on Mars, NASA's Rick Gelbrick told reporters here, 1 year after the U.S. Space Agency unveiled an ambitious plan to site a solar-powered manned outpost on the south pole of the moon. We have the International Space Station, we're going to have a lunar outpost, and someday, certainly someday, we'll go to Mars, said Jeff Hanley, head of NASA's Constellation program, which is developing the tools to return humans to the moon. December 1972, flight of Apollo 17 with CERN, Evans, and Schmidt on board was the last manned mission to the moon for the United States. I also wanted to let you know we've had a lot of weather calamities around the country. If you're in Oklahoma, our consolations go to you. We also want to let you know that you can go to NitroPack at X Squared Radio and you can pick up those 72-hour kits, cold weather kits. Put one in your car, folks, because when you slide off the freeway, help might be on the way, but it might be hours, and you don't want to sit there running your car, because they'll find your car running and you not running. So get yourself a warm weather kit at NitroPack and take care of yourselves. If you were out at night stargazing this last week, you might have made many wishes. The Geminids of 2007 began on December 13th, less flamboyantly than expected, but the shower quickly developed into one of the best Geminid displays in years. According to the International Meteor Organization, counts under ideal dark sky conditions reached 140 meteors per hour. And that was December 15th. It produced an extra helping of fireballs, making the night after the predicted December 14th peak visually best of all.
I think it's quite fascinating that they can predict when the meteor showers are going to happen almost within hours, sometimes even within minutes. A lot of people don't realize how many calculations go into that and make it easy so you don't have to go out night after night looking for those meteors. We can tell you when the best shower is coming. And if you'll stay tuned to X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com each Sunday evening, we'll let you know when those things are going to happen. A very excellent guest tonight is Dr. Ronald Mallett. His book is Time Traveler. And he's also the provisional patenter of the first working time machine. This is a three-hour program, so if you're not getting all 3 hours, just let us know, and we'll do the rest. We are netcasting over the BBS Radio Network and the CDLI Radio Network, and we appreciate our producers. We also want to let you know that our phone lines are open. Toll-free, U.S. and Canada, 888-228-4494. Canada, we have another number for you as well. Lots of listeners up there, 877-489-6350. And anywhere else, on or off planet, if you can reach a cell phone tower, you can get to us at 530-776-5154. You can also reach us at 530-776-5185. And if you're using Skype, you can reach us at BBS Radio. And if you're using PalTalk, you can reach us at BBSRadio_com. No problem getting through to us. And you might want to go ahead and get AOL Instant Messenger and the search for Vision Officer. And that will link you up with me. You can send us questions by Flash, and we'll get those to Dr. Mallett. Well, before we get into some time paradoxes, let's talk about curving space-time with gravity. This is also a key claim to your patent, so let's see if we can bring our listeners up to speed. Tell us how Einstein said gravity acts on the universe.
Right. Well, the key is that according to Einstein, the force that we call gravity is really an illusion. I mean, now let me back up and state why that's so. If you think of the sun and the earth, then we know that, according to Newton, the sun creates a gravitational force that pulls the earth towards it. And because the earth has this sort of sideways motion, that the earth orbits around the sun due to the gravitational attraction of the sun. Now, that is what Newton would say. What Einstein said is that, but Newton didn't know what caused that force. Essentially, it was a description. What Einstein said is that what really gravity really is not a force, but it's the curvature of space. And it's a simple analogy, I think, would be the following. You know, imagine that you have sort of a stretched rubber sheet, like a trampoline, and think of that stretched rubber sheet as being like empty space. And then imagine that you put a bowling ball on that stretched rubber sheet. So that bowling ball is going to push the rubber sheet down. Now, suppose that you take a little marble, and you take that marble, and suppose that what you do is if you just let the marble go, the marble would go right towards the bowling ball. Now, imagine that the rubber sheet is still there, but it's transparent. So you're looking at this bowling ball, and you're looking at this marble. If you put the marble there on the sheet, and it's transparent, it would look to you as though somehow the bowling ball is pulling on the marble. But you know that what's really happening is that the bowling ball is curving the transparent rubber sheet, and the marble is moving along that curve that's produced, and it's moving towards the bowling ball due to that. So what Einstein said is that same thing is happening out in space. In other words, the sun is actually curving the empty space around it, and the earth is moving in that curvature like a skater on a roller derby ring. And in fact, even with the bowling ball on the rubber sheet and the marble, if you take that marble and give it a little sideways motion, then the marble will actually orbit around the bowling ball. So I said like a skater on a roller skating ring. So That's what Einstein said. Einstein said that what we call gravity is really the bending of space. So that is the gravitational force.
So if space is bending, and that's a really neat way to get your kids excited about science, too. Go ahead, put the bowling ball on the trampoline. It's a lot safer than putting your kids on it. And then give that marble or a baseball sort of a sideways sling around that and watch the baseball orbit around that bowling ball. That is really a fascinating visual to pick up. But so if space-time is bending like that, what happens to the path of light in space?
Well, the thing is the path of light will actually follow that same curve. In fact, that was the way in which Einstein proved that science, that the space was being bent like that, was Einstein predicted that, suppose that you have stars that are located behind the sun, and so from here on the Earth, we're not going to be able to see those stars because they're behind the sun. But according to Einstein, since the sun is bending space around it, then the starlight that's going to be coming from some of those stars behind the sun, some of that starlight is going to get bent by the space around the sun, and some of that light will get focused back towards the Earth, so that you would be able to, if you're looking out into space at around the sun, you would actually be able to see stars near the sun that are actually behind the sun, because it would appear to you as though the light's coming, you know, directly from that star. And what's actually happening is that the light is being bent by the sun. So you're able to see that. Now, you might say, well, how are you going to see that if the sun is there? Well, there's a very famous scientist named Eddington who said the way in which we could observe it, and he did, in fact, this observation, was that you look at the night sky where the stars are when the sun isn't there. And then when the sun is in that region, if you look at the sun during a total solar eclipse, so that the sun's sunlight is blocked out, then you would be able to see a shift in the pattern of the stars that are near the sun during the solar eclipse. And that shift would represent those stars that you would normally not have been able to see because they were located behind the sun. So
can't you just see those guys down at the local pub, you know, like, okay, Eddington, how are you going to prove that light curves around the sun? And as he sets his frothy beer down, he says, well, I'll just wait till a solar eclipse, and I'll be able to see a star before it actually pokes its way around the sun. And that's exactly what they did, isn't it?
That's exactly what they did. In 1919, that's exactly what he did.
That's what
made Einstein famous, because in 1919, this had just been 1 year after the First World War, and you have to remember the time that England and Germany hated each other at that point. This was 1919, 1 year after the war, and here was a British scientist, Eddington, proving the theory of a German scientist, Einstein. And what that represented for people was this breath of fresh air, this unification, that here were these two major scientists of nations that had previously been at war with each other. They were now, you know, supporting each other. And people were really that was so uplifting to people, that is what catapulted Einstein into international fame, is because Newton said, at the Royal Society, you know, hats off, gentlemen, a new Newton. And so to say that about a former enemy scientist, it just made the world feel like this could be a new age. And that's when he became famous, was after that observation.
So, and this was repeatable. I mean, lots of people noticed that. Gosh, wait a minute.
Absolutely.
Starlight curving around the sun.
Exactly. Since that time, I mean, the experiment has been done. Every time there's been solar eclipses, people have been able to have set up experiments to do that, and there's always a solar eclipse somewhere. Sometimes it's happening out in the middle of the ocean, but the thing is that there's always a solar eclipse, and then observations have been made of that many, many times. So this is something that, and we're able to see it now, not just simply here with the Earth, but we can see it from starlight being bent by the gravitational field of black holes. We actually see that effect. So we know now that just as Einstein predicted, what an object does, any massive object, is curves the empty space around it, and that everything, light and matter, move in that curvature of space. So that is something that is, that's the key aspect of Einstein's theory, and part of my work is based on this, what this bending of space. And incidentally, one of the things that, I should mention, because sometimes some popularizations don't get it right, gravity is the curvature of space. Gravity doesn't cause the curvature of space. So, and that,
right.
that difference in that is the same, you know what I'm saying? In other words,
yeah.
Right, and so that's an important point. And so, and as I said, that is where my work comes in, is to utilize what that curvature of space that we call gravity. And I've done it in a wholly, in a different way than people had anticipated. And
I find it very fascinating, and I just want to let you know, Earth explorers, that we're not going to go too deep, that you can't keep up. We're going to try and not get into the math too deeply, because I'm a commercial scientist. You know, we don't spend a lot of time on the calculator unless we're trying to figure out how to put unknowns into a known equation or try to blend equations together. But we're not going to get so theoretical that you're going to get lost. So just stick with us. We're going to get there. I was going to ask you, the sun's light, how long does it take to get to Earth from the sun?
It takes 8 minutes. Light is traveling at the speed of light. The sun is about 93 million miles away from us. So light at 186,000 miles per second takes about 8 minutes to get from the sun to the Earth. Which is an interesting effect, because that means that if something happened to destroy the sun, it would take 8 minutes for us to actually see that effect here on the Earth. And,
right,
and of course,
right.
You know,
but what
yeah,
would happen
you know.
To the gravitational pull? I mean, yeah.
Well,
I mean,
see,
the
that's the interesting
away.
Thing. Yeah, the thing is that, remember I was talking about Newton's theory, or Newton's law of gravity. According
right.
to Newton, if the sun is destroyed, then gravity would shut down immediately. And so you would have this weird effect of seeing the sun up there for 8 minutes, but there wouldn't be any gravity. So we would be going off into space, but we wouldn't see the reason why, because we would still see the sun out there. That was another thing that bothered Einstein, because what it was implying was that gravity could travel faster than the speed of light, because if gravity got shut off immediately when the sun was destroyed, then we would be going off into space and we would still see the sun there. And another reason why Einstein developed his theory that gravity was actually the curvature of space was to get around that. And you might say, well, how did he do that? Well, remember we were talking about the trampoline, the rubber sheet representing empty space?
Right.
Well, think about this. If I have that bowling ball on there, and suppose that I all of a sudden suddenly move the bowling ball off the rubber sheet, what's going to happen? That depression where the bowling ball was is going to bounce up, and so there's going to be a ripple from where the bowling ball was that's going to go across the rubber sheet, right? Now, what Einstein said is that the same thing is going to happen with the sun. Suppose the sun is destroyed. Well, if the sun is destroyed, then there's going to be a ripple in that space that's going to come out to the Earth. Now, what Einstein did was, what if you calculate how long it's going to take for that ripple of space to get to the Earth, it turns out that it's going to take 8 minutes, exactly the same amount of time as the light from the sun. In other words, the effect of gravity, the change in gravity when the sun is destroyed, is going to take exactly the same amount of time as it's going to take for light to get from the sun. In other words, we won't know that gravity has been shut down until we can no longer see the sun. That was the other thing Einstein's theory did.
Uh-huh. Well, I have somebody has written in a question, said if you had a wire that extended from the sun to the Earth, and we were getting electrical current along there, and then all of a sudden you shut the switch off at the sun, when would the light go out on the Earth?
The light would not go out until 8 minutes afterwards. you would not see the light going out.
Because the light on the Earth that's being powered by that wire that's going through the switch all the way out there at the sun would burn for 8 minutes after the switch was turned off at the sun.
That's right.
Interesting.
You would, right. No effect would be faster than the shutting down of the sun.
Mm. That's interesting. Interesting.
Yeah.
Nice.
Oh, incidentally, the other thing that I wanted to point out is that we were talking about the effect of that, how gravity affected time.
Right.
The bending of space is connected with the bending of time. In Einstein's theory, whatever you do to space also happens to time. And the bending of time is what shows up to us as the slowing down of time. In other words, that's how we know that time is being bent. The stronger space is being bent, the more time is being bent, and that shows up as clocks running slower. So a clock near the sun is running slower than as you move away from the sun, because space is more strongly bent and time is more strongly bent. And that's another important aspect of it. Whatever you do to space also happens to time. Now,
if mass is curving space and thus curving time, does light have mass?
Aha, no, it doesn't. And you see, this is now where you're getting towards my theory. Because what most people don't realize, and in fact, many scientists who haven't studied relativity, they don't realize is that in Newton's theory, the only thing that can create gravity is mass, is matter, like the Earth or whatever. But in Einstein's theory, not only can mass create gravity, but energy can create gravity. Light can create gravity. In other words, even though light does not have mass, light does have energy. And the energy of light can create gravity. And now you can begin to actually see the reasoning that I use that's actually at the core of my work. If light can create gravity, in other words, if light can cause this bending of space, if light can create gravity and gravity can affect time, then that means that light can affect time. That's the core of my idea, is to use light to change time. And that's the reasoning. Light can create gravity and gravity can affect time. That means that light can affect time. And the way in which you can see this and how this is actually the way in which, because what I was interested in is traveling into the past. And you might say, well, how are you going to do that? By using light and gravity. And there's actually a very, very simple way to see it. And this is where the connection with my work at United Technologies came in. It turns out that you can create, light normally travels in a straight line, but it turns out that there are ways that you can cause light to go into a circulating pattern. There's a device that's actually called a ring laser, but the main point is that what it does is it allows light, rather than go along just a straight path, it allows light to travel around in a sort of a circular path so that you can create a circulating beam of light. Rather than a straight beam of light, you can create a circulating beam of light. And there's a number of different ways that you can do that, but that's the key. But now if you have a circulating beam of light, it does something very interesting to space. And the way that you can understand what it does to space is in this very simple way. Imagine that you have a cup of coffee in front of you. Think of the coffee in your cup as being like empty space. Think of your spoon as being like a circulating light beam. Now, if you take your spoon and stir the coffee, what's going to happen to the coffee as you stir it? It swirls around. It creates sort of a vortex in the coffee. Well, the circulating light beam is going to do the same thing in the empty space about which the beam is circulating. In other words, it's going to cause the empty space to swirl around just like the spoon did to the coffee. Now, you might say, if it's empty space, how am I going to see that? Well, in the case of the coffee, suppose you take a sugar cube and you drop it into the coffee. Then as you take the spoon and stir the coffee is going to cause the sugar cube to get dragged around. So you could actually tell that the coffee is being swirled around by just looking at the sugar cube, because the coffee is going to drag the sugar cube around. Now, in the case of the empty space, if I have the circulating light beam, the empty space within that circulating light beam is going to be pulled around. But if you take a little subatomic particle that's called a neutron is in part of every atom. If you take this neutron and you put it into that empty space, then even though you're not going to be able to see the empty space getting dragged around, as you're stirring the empty space with the circulating light beam, the space is going to drag the neutron around. And you can see that. So you'll know that the space is being dragged around because you'll see the neutron getting dragged around, just like the sugar cube and the coffee is getting dragged around. Now, remember what we said earlier, that in Einstein's theory, whatever you do to space, it's also going to happen to time. So if I'm going to cause a twisting of space, then this is going to affect time in the following way. Normally, we think of time as a straight line. Just imagine that you draw a straight line on a piece of paper, and at the bottom of the line, you put yesterday, and at the middle of the line, you put today, and at the top of the line, you put tomorrow. Now, even though we're unconscious of it, all of us move along this timeline from yesterday to today to tomorrow. But if space is being twisted by the circulating light beam, then that twisting of space is going to also twist time into a loop. So imagine you take that straight line on that piece of paper, and you take that straight line and you twist it into a loop. So you attach the bottom of the line to the top of the line. Now you can see what's going to happen. If you start at what you called the past on that line and you move along that line, remember you've made the line into a loop, so you're moving along that line, you move to today, the present, and then you continue along that line, that loop, to the future, tomorrow. But remember, what you've done is you've attached the bottom of the line to the top of the line, so that means you can move from the future back to the past. So by creating the circulating, using the circulating light beam and twisting space, you can twist time from a straight line into a loop. And along that loop in time, you can travel back into the past.
Was it Planck that said that, I think you were talking about a spinning bucket hanging from a ceiling in a room, and I think you made the observation, well, what if I was on a little boat and I was actually on the water in the bucket and you actually spun the room in the bucket? Would the water curve too?
Right, exactly. And here you're what you're doing is you're actually twisting space, because in Einstein's theory, space acts like a substance, just like, you know, with the bowling ball on the trampoline. Well, space actually also acts like it was a fluid, so that you could actually cause space to become swirled around. And another way of doing that is by using rotating. You can rotate matter. In fact, you can use, like, the Earth will actually cause the empty space around it. As the Earth revolves, it's causing the empty space around it to become twisted around. But in my work, what I found was that a circulating beam of light will cause the empty space to get twisted around. And that empty space that will lead to a twisting of time into a loop. And along that loop in time, you would be able to travel back into the past.
Now, light has a couple of properties, both of which convert readily into energy. One is that it's a particle like a photon, and the other is that it's a wave. How are you applying light and the energy of light to drag this space around?
Right. Well, the thing is that, remember, in addition to light having energy, light also flows. That is to say that light moves.
Right.
And it's actually the flow of the light that I'm using to cause the twisting of space. Okay? So that's, yeah, exactly. So the fact that the light is flowing, that is what I'm using to drag space around.
I have used X-ray fluorescence spectroscopy. It's XRF, or you actually bombard precious metals. I did it with a catalyst slurry, and it sputters off an electron using the X-rays, and then you detect the photon that results when an electron in a higher energy state falls in to fill that slot.
Right.
And that's called fluorescence. And that has a specific wavelength. That photon has a specific wavelength that identifies that precious metal. In our case, we were looking for platinum or rhodium or palladium, and we wanted it out to 4 decimal places, and that's really the only way to do it is with XRF. So the light energy that you're using is in a specific wavelength, or any wavelength will do.
Any wavelength. It's just a matter of the energy that you're using of the light. But that energy is necessary, but it's not. But it's also, as I said, there's two things that are going on. One is the energy of the light, but the other is the flow of the light. The fact that the light is moving. Okay, because that is the stirring effect that I was talking about. In other words, if you think of one way of getting light to move around, circulate, is if you think, let's suppose that you have a square, and at each corner of the square you have a mirror. And suppose that you send a light beam, a laser beam, from one mirror to another mirror along the side of the square. When it hits that mirror at the one corner, the light will be reflected to the next corner along the other side of the square. And then when it hits the far corner, it'll be reflected down to allow the other side of the square till it hits the bottom mirror. So, and then it'll get reflected back to the original mirror. So if you have a mirror at each corner of a square and you send a light beam along one side, then the light beam will bounce around and hit each mirror, and so it will actually circulate by going along the edges of the square. So that's where you can create a circulating beam of light, is by having the light go from one mirror to the other. And then that region within the square, which is the empty space, it's actually getting stirred around because the light is flowing from the one mirror to the other mirror. So that is the effect. That's what's causing the stirring of the empty space, is the flow of the light. And if you increase the energy of the light that's flowing, then that will increase the strength of the twisting. In other words, imagine that you take your spoon and you're stirring, but if you decide to take your spoon and stir more vigorously, so you're giving that stirring motion more energy. So that's going to cause the coffee to swirl even more. Well, that's what the energy, so the strength of the swirling is like the strength that you would be using on your spoon.
I was kind of thinking of it like a little bit of energy would be just like dipping the tip of the spoon in the water of the coffee, and maybe more energy would be like really digging down deep with that spoon and getting a good drag. I think we have a caller on the line. Caller, your first name and where you're calling from, please.
Hi there, Cindy from Washington State.
Hello,
hi.
Cindy.
Hi. I have one quick question. I love your corollaries, by the way. Those are great. Are you intimating or stating then that space is semi-fluidic?
That's right, exactly. In Einstein's theory, it is exactly so. You're absolutely right.
That's what allows that
stirring effect that I was talking about.
Right. Wonderful. Well, that's all I wanted to know, but your information is fascinating.
Oh, thank you very much.
I thought you were going to ask if it was caffeinated or decaffeinated.
Well, I look forward to reading your book.
Oh, well, thank you.
We'll make
sure you
get
your
hands on it.
You bet.
I told you we had great listeners. I mean, they just pick up on this stuff. I could see, you know, they're all sitting out there next to their computers with their credit cards in their hands listening to the program. That's what makes a netcast radio a little different than the drive-by radio, because, you know, those people that really don't care much about listening to the radio on the Internet don't really know how powerful our listeners are, because our listeners aren't in cars. They're sitting in a credit card in their hands. So they're really powerful. They can affect the universe in a big way. Thanks for the call, Cindy. Yeah, that is a very good analogy with the coffee. I really like it, and it just reminded me of that. You know, I could just see these guys. You know, about the third or fourth beer, they start getting very cerebral, and they begin to pontificate and say, "Hey, wouldn't it be neat if we could do this?" And I would just, wouldn't you just love to spend a couple of hours with Bohr and Einstein and Heisenberg?
Oh, yes.
Holy cow, you know, maybe one day they'll say, wow, wouldn't it have been neat to sit around with Dr. Agnew and Dr. Mallett and talk about it at the same time?
Yes.
We'll see. Though I've got some really cool stuff in the third hour you're really going to like. I mean, you may include it in your second book. So, well, let's talk a little bit about time itself and some of the paradoxes that go with it.
Oh, yes.
I think, you know, we've all had these very powerful desires to go back in time, as you have, and do or undo something. I love the Dennis Quaid movie, Frequency, and even recent movie, the recent one.
Deja Vu?
Yeah, Deja Vu with Denzel Washington. Boy, that was a real twisted up paradox.
Yeah.
So tell us about the grandfather paradox you mentioned in your book.
Right. Right. Incidentally, I don't know if there's something in passing that I should mention that's interesting about the two movies, just as a bit of trivia. Frequency and Deja Vu was that the person who played the hero in Frequency played the villain in Deja Vu.
That's right. I never thought about that, but you're absolutely right. Yeah, the cop played the bad guy.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay, I'm writing that one down. Good observation. All right, let's talk about the grandfather paradox.
The grandfather paradox, right. That's, in fact, one of the most famous and classic problems that people think of when they talk about time travel into the past. And just to sort of remind the listeners, if you suppose that you go back into the past and accidentally do something like, let's suppose you prevent your grandfather from meeting your grandmother somehow. Well, if they never get together, then they don't have your parents. And if they don't have your parents, then your parents don't have you. And if your parents don't have you, then how are you able to go back into the past?
Back to the future.
Right. So that's right, exactly. And so the point is that the grandfather paradox says essentially that how is it possible to go back in the past and to do something that might affect your own existence? And in fact, there are two ways that people have thought about that problem. One is the fact that if you go back into the past, no matter what it is that you do there to try to prevent your grandparents from getting together, they will have. You know, in other words, if you prevent them that day, they'll get together some other day. But they will, in fact, somehow get together. And that's called the deterministic thing. In other words, that whatever it is that you do into the past, it will fit into what we already know about the present. And so even though you will have changed the past, to us in the present, it will seem as though nothing has happened because it will always fit the pattern that leads to what we know of is existing.
Right.
The other one, which is much more exotic, has to do with quantum theory. And it says that you can go back and you really can change the past, but the past you change is the past of a parallel universe. See, in quantum theory, and this was originally developed by a physicist who wasn't trying to apply it to time travel. It was this man named Hugh Everett. He was a physicist in the 50s. And what he did was to apply quantum theory to the universe as a whole. And he came to the conclusion that our universe may be just one of many parallel universes that are very much like ours. But in each one of these different universes, things are slightly different. But they appear so close that the differences are very, very minor. And now you might say, how does this apply to time travel? Well, the notion is that when you go back into the past, at the instant that you arrive in the past, you arrive in the past of a parallel universe. It has to be very similar to the universe you left, because it actually has to have a time machine in it, like the time machine that you had the original universe. But nevertheless, it's in a parallel universe. And in that parallel universe, you can prevent your grandparents from meeting each other. And in that parallel universe, you would find yourself in a strange universe in which your grandparents didn't meet each other, but you're in that universe. And so you were never born in it, but still you're in that universe. However, the universe in which you left is not affected, because it gives rise to everything that leads to your existence. So the notion is that you can affect the past, but the past that you affect is the past of a parallel universe. And that leads to a strange philosophical notion and the notion of sacrifice, because That means that if you went to the past, you could prevent an assassination, for example, from happening, but that would sacrifice you to your original world. You would be in a world in which you have changed the past, and that person that was going to be assassinated isn't assassinated. And so, but now you're just in that new universe, and you can't get back home again. You can never leave that parallel universe. You could travel to the future of that parallel universe, but you can never get back to the original universe.
Well, that's kind of interesting. There was another movie pretty recent called The One with Jet Li in it, where he actually goes around to the different parallel universes and knocks off his parallel self. So he collects all of his energy from all the universes into one, and he increases in energy each time he does that.
Right. Yeah, the thing is that, and that was a good movie. That was an entertaining movie. But this effect is like uncontrollable in the context that this would happen. That is to say that you would have no control in selecting the universe. In other words, you would end up in a universe, but you would not be able to control that. And if you went into another universe, you wouldn't be able to control that. And in the one, he would have a problem because according to quantum theory, there's an infinite number of these different universes. So he would, he'd have his work cut out.
He'd be busy, wouldn't he? We call that the potential of all potentialities.
All right.
One of my IMers is asking if you've ever heard of the apparent time traveler John Titor.
Yeah, he's a fiction. He's a construct. The thing is that one of the other things is that with time travel, and this is something that's very important, and I think it's important for physicists, for the public to realize, is the fact that with real time travel, and this is actually something that led to a bit of sadness for me initially, you can travel back into the past, but you're limited by the machine. You cannot travel earlier than when you turn the machine on. So suppose that I had the time machine now, and I turned it on, and I left it on for 10 years, then someone could come back from 10 years from now. They could come back 7 years, 5 years, all the way back up to the point the machine was turned on. But you can't go back earlier than when the machine was turned on. If you think about it, this makes perfect physical sense, and it answers the question why, if we have time travelers of the past, were not inundated with time travelers. It's the device that's creating the effect. And so that means that when you switch the machine on, it's creating the circulating loops in time. But before the device is turned on, there are no circulating loops. And so a time traveler, if you leave it on for 100 years, for a human scale time machine, then time travelers could travel back up to any point up to the time the device is turned on, but you need the device to materialize in.
Gotcha.
And this is also something that's important, and this is the reason why when it comes to talking about being skeptical, and I tell my students that this is the point, is that if someone says to you, look, I'm a time traveler from the future, then you should say very respectfully to them, oh, that's great. Will you please show me your time machine? Because that's the point. With a real time machine, it doesn't matter how it's created, whether it's done by wormholes or cosmic strings. And in my book, Time Traveler, I do talk about these other processes. I talk about how wormholes can be used as time machines and how cosmic strings can be used as time machines. Doesn't matter. You cannot go back earlier than when the process started. And
right.
So this is the limitation. Now, there is a way around that limitation, but it has to do with a whole another way in which we would have to approach the possibility of time travel into the past.
We'll talk about that a little bit more in the third hour. I'm going to get to the solution. We're trying to walk people somewhat linearly through this process. If we skip to the end, then we'll have to do an hour's worth of commercials, and we don't want to.
Right. Good point. Very good point.
You said in your book, though, suppose that a suitable encrypted transceiver receives a message from the future. If we act on the message, then we have chosen a particular universe. In other words, a new path. And I thought, you know, that's very profound, because many people believe we have just such a thing in the scriptures. We have a vision from the future. Or is it?
I see what you're saying.
You know, according to the laws of physics, we could choose another future, right?
That's exactly right. And you're right. And no matter how we get the information in the present, we
right.
could utilize that to, if we act on that, then we are going to change the future. And we can choose to act on it or not. And if we do, then we are going to alter. We're going to select out a new future.
Yeah.
From all
yeah,
the possible futures that we could
have
had.
We don't have to march that eschatological path to Armageddon. We can just pick another universe.
That's right. That's right. But the thing is that we have to be consciously aware that that's what we're doing, and also try to be aware of the consequences of what it is that we're doing. And that, unfortunately, is not something that we're always are.
We need a whole new set of prophets then. You know, I recall reading in Kip Thorne's book, he had a great book called Black Holes and Time Warp.
Oh, yes.
That thing is so dog-eared. I've made so many notes in it. And he mentioned a math model where I guess he and Stephen Hawking had bounced this back and forth off each other, and they had hypothetically tossed cue balls through a wormhole and then back again. And evidently, mathematically speaking, the cue balls collide into themselves on the way through the wormhole. How does that work?
Well, I mean, if you're talking about, what they were talking about is essentially the pool ball version of the grandfather paradox, and which is to say that, you know, if you send something back into the past and it collides with itself, then how? I mean, that I'm just, you know, conjecturing that that's what it was that they were trying to do, was to talk about, you know, with the wormhole, what you can do is set things up so that you can see, you can send something towards the object that's getting ready to go into the other mouth of the wormhole in such a way that it could be possible that it could be sighted. So the question is that if you did that, would you be able to cause it to collide with itself? And if you did, then you could arrive at a contradiction like the grandfather paradox. And the way of getting around that, once again, is by looking at the possibility of parallel universe. Because it doesn't matter. Because if you have this collision happening in another universe, in a parallel universe, then you're not arriving at a contradiction of seeing something that you know didn't happen in the original universe.
Right, right, right. Okay, so let's talk about that wormhole. How does that work in De Sitter space?
Well, the way in which the wormhole works is that the two mouths, now I'll just remind the listeners what a wormhole is, essentially. And let's go back to the trampoline, the rubber sheet model.
Yeah.
And suppose that what you did was on this rubber sheet, let's suppose that you took and cut a hole in one end of the sheet, and at the other end of the sheet you cut a hole. And then let's suppose you took a rubber tube and connected the two holes together.
Uh-huh.
That's a wormhole. Okay, so a wormhole would be a tunnel, a tube that's connecting the two holes that you've cut out in space.
Right.
So that's
Now, how does tunneling work in physics?
Okay, well, the thing is that essentially what you would be doing is moving directly, another analogy, rather than using the rubber sheet, is that just suppose that you take a ball, just an ordinary ball, and suppose you put point A on one part of the ball and you put point B on the another end of the ball. Now, there's one way that you normally can get from point A to point B on the ball, and that's just to move along the surface of the ball. And that would take you a certain amount of time to do that. Another way you could do is suppose you drilled a hole through the ball directly from point A to point B. Then that way it's going to take you less time than it going across the surface of the ball. The wormhole would be that tunnel that you've drilled through there.
Mm-hmm.
So the tunnel is a region that isn't in ordinary space but connects two different points in the space. and you can utilize that to go from point A to point B, is to go through this tunnel. And the tunnel is in kind of a space it's sort of a hypothetical space. Sometimes people call it a hyperspace, but it's not the space along which you would normally move. And this mouth, this tunnel, this wormhole is what connects the two mouths. Now, the way in which it can be used as a time machine is that, remember that I said that the faster an object goes, the more time slows down?
Right.
According to Einstein. Now, suppose that you take one of the mouths of the wormhole and you move that mouth around very, very rapidly, then time near that mouth is going to slow down relative to the time outside of the mouth. So that when you bring that mouth back to rest, the time around that mouth will be at a different time than the time outside of the wormhole. Now, suppose that you have a rocket coming in from outside space, and then it comes to the mouth of that wormhole. So let's suppose it's 1 o'clock outside the mouth of the wormhole, but at the mouth of the wormhole, it's 12 o'clock. As you move through the mouth of the wormhole along the tunnel out and pop out the other side, then if you come back, you'll be still at 12 o'clock when you pop out of the other side of the mouth of the wormhole. If you look back, you will actually be able to see yourself coming into the wormhole at 1 o'clock. So that is how you could actually go back into the past. You could actually travel and see yourself coming into the wormhole at some later time. So it's by moving the mouth of the wormhole that you can change time and slow time down and then use it as a time machine.
Interesting. One of the arguments, well, not arguments, one of the pontifications that Kip Thorne and Stephen Hawking and others have had, and I've written a couple papers on it myself, is the stability of the wormhole, because the original assumption was that it took some kind of exotic matter to hold it open from the inside. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that later, but I went to the Boston Museum of Science, and I got to tell you, that is an awesome place for kids.
Oh, yes, I've lectured there. And it's
even one thing.
It is.
Because they have the largest Van de Graaff generators in the world there, and they do a lightning show, a really incredible lightning show at that museum, and they do it daily, and it's just spectacular. I mean, they fire up these big Tesla coils, and they shoot off these 20-foot lightning bolts in there, and you're basically sitting there in your jeans and a T-shirt watching guys play with millions of volts of electricity, and it's awesome. But hanging from the ceiling, and I don't know, they're probably hanging from the ceiling of every science museum, is a neon model of the Einstein-Rosen bridge. I wanted to ask you how you thought Einstein and Rosen got together. How did they corroborate on that?
Well, the thing is that what they were doing was just looking at different solutions associated with Einstein's equations. I mean, you can ask yourself what are possible models, what are things that you can do. And then in the original Einstein-Rosen bridge, it really is what we call a wormhole, but the difference is that a wormhole, and I should mention that the name wormhole was originally developed by the same man who developed the word black hole, John Wheeler. John Wheeler coined the word for black holes. He also coined the word for wormholes. The difference between a wormhole and the Einstein-Rosen bridge is that the wormhole connects two different regions of our space by a tunnel. The Einstein-Rosen bridge connects two different regions in two different universes. In other words, the mouth of one is connected with the mouth of another, but in another universe. That's the difference.
Well, to me, it was like putting peanut butter and chocolate together. It was amazing to see this mathematical solution hanging in neon lights from like a mobile in the ceiling of this museum. And it kind of got me excited, and I started reading everything I could get my hands on, because it just really created this image for me. So So we have this neon, looks like a tornado, as a mathematical embed hanging from the ceiling. And I wondered at that time what it would be like to put two of them together at the small ends. Would it be possible that black holes form this kind of curvature in space?
Oh, yeah. Well, the thing is that that's one way in which you can do it, is you can actually connect mouths from different wormholes. The thing is that you have to realize that this is something that also isn't sometimes clearly stated when people talk about wormholes. You can actually think of the mouth of the wormhole as being like a black hole, but you have to remember that if it is really like a black hole, then you couldn't come out the other end, because once you're inside a black hole, you can't get back out.
Yeah, you're done.
Right. The physicists have actually done is they've done a sort of a surgical process. They do this mathematically on the mouth of the black hole, and they sort of cut out that region that would prevent you from being able to get out of the black hole. So it's not really like a black hole. So that's what allows you to go into the mouth of the wormhole and come back out again, is they sort of cut off the thing that technically it's called an event horizon, but what it amounts to is it amounts to the region that would actually prevent you from getting out of the wormhole, out of the mouth of the black hole. And so that's as I said, it's a little sleight of hand that's really done to allow the wormhole to work.
Very interesting. Well, when you look at that, that model, and you think about the way that we can exotically, mathematically treat these, And the thing that really impresses me is, guys, these men did not have computers, okay? They did all this with a slide rule and a pencil, okay? But when you look at the embed, this neon Einstein-Rosen bridge, you wonder what a black hole would do to, and you mentioned the rubber ball with the A and the B on it. What would it do to consider space? And I sat there on the bench waiting for the show to start, and I looked up at it and I thought, well, what if you could finish the math model to its last decimal place? Would the flare at one end of this shape in the ceiling curve completely around to meet the plane of the flare at the other end, sort of like a trumpet flare coming around to join up with the mouthpiece? And now you have a De Sitter balloon where the A and B has been pushed together, so they're back-to-back, where you've just basically created a gravity event that pulls the two sides of the balloon, the De Sitter balloon, back-to-back.
But the thing is that you have to remember, though, that the balloon that you're talking about, in fact, people have looked at what happens to black holes in De Sitter space. And the thing is that the De Sitter space is expanding. So this region that you're talking about would also be expanding, and essentially what you would do is you would take you could make a small wormhole into a big wormhole by using the expansion of the De Sitter space, and that's what would be happening. Now I'm trying to imagine, is that what you're picturing?
Yeah, and it might be stable for millions of years, and it might be navigable by travelers from other worlds.
It's possible. It's possible. The thing is that the problem is that even if we were seeing the mouth of the wormhole, we wouldn't necessarily know that it was the mouth of the wormhole, because we wouldn't be able to see the other end. So, you see what I'm saying? That's where the difficulty comes in.
Right, because of the curvature of space, sort of like you can only see about 9 miles on the ocean because of the curvature of space.
Right.
It's curving similar to that. Well, we're at the top of our second hour. Gosh, I can't believe how fast this goes. So we are going to take another about 3.5-minute break, and we will be back right after some messages. My guest tonight is Dr. Ronald Mallett, and we're talking about his book Time Traveler, and we're going to talk about his time machine in the next hour. So don't go away. We've got more coming on X Squared Radio.
friends down at NRG Resources have introduced a new engine oil technology. TVT 24/7 is the future of lubrication. This is the industry's first environmentally friendly oil additive that not only increases fuel mileage, it reduces engine, gearbox, and transaxle wear to nothing. The other brands fail anti-friction testing in less than 10 minutes under standard testing conditions. TVT 24/7 went more than 24 hours in the test and still did not fail. Get tomorrow's technology today by visiting the online store at X Squared Radio and pick up TVT 24/7 Engine Oil Energizer. There is some place you should visit before the end of the week. The Horizon Project is probably the most important examination of future events in the world today. But there is a reason you should visit their website soon. I can't give you all the details here, but I can tell you that the first DVD in the six-part series is now available for pre-purchase at $5 off. This series will no doubt be airing on the History Channel or Discovery Channel, but you need the uncut version with all of the bonus material. Trust me, it may be one of the most important video productions you will ever see. Click on the Horizon Project banner at X Squared Radio today. If you have survived a disaster without food and clean water, then you need to visit NitroPack. They have been providing emergency preparedness supplies for more than 19 years. They have everything from 72-hour kits to a full year's supply for an entire family. We wanted you to have access to the best. That is why we searched for many months to find NitroPack. Click the NitroPack banner at X Squared Radio and get prepared. The foundations of religion and science were utilized to write our first two volumes of The Ark of Millions of Years. The third volume, called Unlocking the Secret, is about to hit the presses. We want you to be aware of what is coming. You and I know that your potential is absolutely unlimited. We have crafted the final work of the trilogy, so you have the tools necessary to work the law of attraction. Find out what the ancient masters knew. Learn the methods necessary to affect the universe on purpose for the good of your life. Go to the online store at X Squared Radio and get your copy on order today. This is Brooks Agnew with X Squared Radio with a message for our friends in the radio broadcast world. If you have noticed that your listeners aren't around anymore, it's because they are right here with us. If you would like them back in your radio fold, then all you have to do is add X Squared Radio to your program content. The statistics don't lie. We are now the fastest growing talk radio program in North America. Don't be late, because we are about to launch another hour of X Squared Radio. We're so glad you're back with us on X Squared Radio. We're coming to you live from Eastern Washington State, where it's cold and crisp tonight. We're glad you're here. We've got our very excellent guest, Ronald Mallett, with us, PhD. He has written a book called Time Traveler. And he has invented a time machine, and we're going to talk about it this hour. A newly announced NASA mission will examine the moon's interior with more than 100 times the sensitivity of previous missions. The spacecraft, due to launch in 2011, will do this by measuring irregularities in the moon's gravity field. The moon is under a lot of scrutiny lately, with four missions expected to be in lunar orbit by the end of 2008. Japan's Kyuga spacecraft and China's Chang'e 1 probe are already there, having arrived in October and November of this year, respectively. These two missions should soon be joined by India's Chandrayaan 1 orbiter and NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, both scheduled for launch in 2008. Now, NASA has announced another moon mission called GRAIL for Gravity Recovery and Internal Laboratory. It will launch in 2011 to make sensitive measurements of the moon's gravity field. The mission's chief scientist is Maria Zuber of MIT. GRAIL's measurements will allow scientists to reconstruct how the moon's crust has reacted to pummeling by impacts, Zuber says. Variations in crustal thickness contain information on how major impacts have redistributed the crust, she says. My guest tonight is Dr. Ronald Mallett, the inventor of a time machine and the author of Time Traveler. If you missed the first 2 hours of the program tonight, you're out of luck. No, we're just kidding. You can listen on the archives in a few hours by going to X Squared Radio at x2-radio.com. We'll put one of these hours in the free podcast area and then the other 2 hours in the subscription area. If you want to listen to this one, you need to listen to it twice because there's a lot going on tonight with Dr. Ronald Mallett. We're having an awesome time. Speaking of time, we are ready to travel. I think we have all the tools now. We've laid a good groundwork with gravity and with time and with light. Now, you mentioned this epiphany in the second hour you had when you discovered how far back in time you could go. You still feel the same way, right? You can go back to, when it's turned on.
That's right. I mean, that's physics. I mean, it's no matter what device one's using or what process one's using, whether it's terrestrial or not, you can only go back to the point at which the machine is turned on. And the way I like to express that sometimes is the fact that when the first human-scale time machine is built, our descendants will be able to visit us, but we won't be able to visit our ancestors. Now, I should mention that in my own research, what I'm trying to do is to use signals and subatomic particles and send them back into the past, not human beings. I mean, eventually that will happen. But what I'm, my work only deals with trying to send signals and subatomic particles. The other thing, however, and this is, it's important because of the fact that it touches on something that we've only learned in the 1990s about our universe, and it's something that is very, very exciting. It has to do with the notion of extrasolar planets. These are planets that are orbiting other suns, other stars, rather than our own, and they're in our galaxy and in other galaxies. And before the 90s, it was not known that this was so. Now we've actually have over 200 of these extrasolar planets. Now, the importance of this is the fact that many of these planets are beginning to approach the size that makes them Earth-like. And you can see the significance of that. That means that and this is just in the neighborhood of our own galaxy, and they're not all that far away. The thing is, some of them 50,000 light years is a great distance, but nevertheless, it's close by. But the thing is that this means that if these Earth-like planets, some of them will be inhabitable. This means that the universe, and this is just within the neighborhood of our own galaxy, this means that the universe is very likely teeming with life. Now, this, as I said, this existence of these extrasolar planets is established scientific fact. This is no longer conjecture.
Sure.
Now, the fact is that on some of these planets, there will be life that's more primitive than ours. But on some of these planets, there will be life that is much more advanced than us.
Well, it makes sense that there would be a normal distribution of levels of intelligence given a number of planets.
Exactly. Now, on some of those more advanced planets, they will have developed time travel technology much earlier than us. Let's suppose they've developed it 10,000 years ago in their history. Their devices will still have the same limitation. I mean, in other words, if they have developed this 10,000 years ago, that's as far as they're going to be able to go. But you can see what it would mean for us. Eventually, when we are able to go out into space, and if we develop the space technology that's necessary, and we go to one of these planets, then we could use their time machine to travel back to our distant past, up to however long it was that they had developed their time travel technology. That means that ultimately, we may be able to see what ancient Rome and ancient Egypt were like once we were able to use one of these alien time machines.
That makes a lot of sense. That you could build a receiver right now and just wait for information to arrive from the future. It might arrive right after you turn it on.
That's right. In other words, if you create the device today and have a suitable receiver connected, and assuming that you leave the machine on continuously, that's another important point,
right,
then eventually information from the future could be sent back to you, and this could lead to scientific advance. It could lead to all sorts of possibilities of information coming into our time from the future that we could utilize to boost our own technology. And
that's what excites me. I mean, time machines will be created in the future, and what more interesting time to reach back to than this one, when the time machine inventor made his first working model. You know,
you've
made history already, and history will be studied in the future, and you will receive a message from another machine in the future.
That's right. That's very likely. And the thing, however, is that right now is that we're trying to get the funding necessary to complete the experiments that we're trying to develop. And that's the stage, I mean, that we're at right now is actually funding. Unfortunately, sometimes people get the note, and I should mention that one of my favorite fun science fiction movies of all time is Back to the Future. But unfortunately, people sometimes get their ideas about how science is done from Back to the Future. You know, we have crazy Doc Brown going into his garage and coming out with a DeLorean that he utilizes. Real science doesn't work that way. It requires scientific teamwork and a huge amount of finances. And just to begin to develop the prototype that we're looking at is going to require $250,000. That's to begin, and that's not the total amount. It will cost probably on the order of to just show that the space twisting effect is going to occur would probably cost on the order of $12 million, and you have to see that space is going to be twisted before you go to the next stage to see that time
right.
is going to be twisted
right.
So but that's the stage that we're at right now, is that we're doing funding. And I, one of the things that I've been very grateful about is that my project has been approved by my university, the University of Connecticut, so that it's been given a tax donation status. That is to say that the contributions that are given are actually tax deductible by contributors. And that has helped us enormously as far as getting contributions. And we're also trying to get funding from foundations. And so we'll eventually get the funding, but it's a long haul trying to get the sufficient funding
that we need. That's what's wonderful about shows like X Squared Radio, is that, you know, our listeners are sitting out there, and tomorrow morning, Monday morning, you know, millions of them will go to work and they will log on to the archives with their PC or their laptop at work while they're working on their projects, and they'll listen to this program. And what we tell our listeners and have for years now is that, you know, research like this, breakthrough research, takes funding. Now, you're already being taxed. You don't have any choice over that. But I'm sure you're not really happy with the way your tax money is being spent everywhere. So you can make the choice.
just set aside a few hundred dollars a year for a research tax on yourself, a voluntary one, and you're going to send it out to various projects that you like. And if you like time travel, and judging by the way you guys go to the box office when these time travel movies air, and buy these time travel books when they come in print, this is a project that you could invest in and realize a really great return. If for nothing else, just the pure satisfaction of having helped the first time machine to be turned on. So that's how it's done, folks. And all you really have to do is go to Ronald Mallett's website, which is www.physics.ucon, that's UConn.edu, and there will be information there for how you can get funding, even if it's a few dollars at a time, a few million of you doing it, and this is a done deal. That's
yes,
the power
that's right.
that these listeners have.
That's right.
So,
Thank you.
I'm rubbing my hands together because I'm really excited now. Your assumption that photons can drag space, that energy from lasers can drag space, was applied. And how did that work? What did you see happen?
Well, that's the thing. It was applied theoretically. I'm a theoretical physicist, I should mention.
Okay.
In physics, there's a very precise division of labor between theoretical and experimental physics. Einstein was a theoretical physicist. In other words, he came up with equals mc squared, the equation. He didn't build the bomb using that equation. That was done by experimental physicists and engineers. And my work is the same. I'm a theoretical physicist, and I developed the fundamental equations. And I have an experimental partner who's an expert in lasers. And the thing is that what we need the funding is to actually, he needs it for the equipment to actually show that it's that my equations are working. It would be the equivalent of getting the funding that was necessary to develop the atomic bomb, which was billions of dollars. So it took Einstein, just his brain, to develop the equation, but it takes an enormous amount of funding. And as I said, we have the basic equations, and what we need is the funding in order to develop it into hardware.
I understand. And we want to make sure that this funding, at least from my standpoint, because we're all about peaceful, positive results from everything, that the funding comes from you, the listener, instead of the military or somebody interested in possible military use of a time machine. So, all right, let's just jump back into the theory. Let's suppose that we're putting this thing together. Now, you're going to try two things, right? You're going to try polarized light, and you're going to try neutrons. So tell us about polarized light. What is polarized light?
Okay, well, normal light, the way of thinking about light is that light is like a vibration that's moving along a string. In other words, suppose you take a string and you have one end of it fixed, and let's suppose you take the other end of it and you move the rope up and down. Then you get a wave that moves along the rope, okay? A light wave is like that. It's like a wave that's moving along a rope. And the thing is that up and down vibration is what could be called the plane of polarization. In other words, as the wave is moving down the rope is vibrating up and down. And that up and down direction is what one calls polarized. Now, ordinary light is vibrating in every single direction. In other words, not just simply up and down, but side to side, so that it's moving in one particular direction, but its vibration is going, as I said, not just simply up and down, but it's going side to side and every which way. So
yeah,
that's
like
what's
it's
called
like
unpolarized, right?
Like
and so what you can
light.
Do is...
It's like a cone of light.
Yeah, that's right. You can do it's just vibrating in every single direction. It's moving in one direction, but up and down. It's not just simply up and down vibration. It's moving,
right.
You know, in every different way. And that's unpolarized light. Now, the thing is that you can polarize light in a number of different ways. In fact, if ordinary light from the sun, for example, bounces off of a car hood, then it will actually select out one particular vibration direction. And that's how polarized sunglasses work. Because your polarized sunglasses, the light that's reflected off of the car hood, it's only vibrating in one particular plane. And your polarized lenses actually block out that, so that the reflected light, you don't get that glare, because polarized sunglasses actually block out that direction of vibration.
That's okay. Why an emerald green vehicle looks black if you wear polarized sunglasses.
Yeah, right. Because it's just blocking out whatever that glare is that you're getting off of the hood.
Right.
Now, the thing is that in sending the laser beam around, from, as I was talking about, you know, the laser beam along the square to create from one mirror to another mirror to create the circulating beam of light. When I did the calculation initially, I chose one particular direction of vibration as it was moving around. You don't have to do that. That's not key. In other words, what's key is just simply that the light is moving in a particular direction. So it's the fact that it's moving from one corner of the square to the next corner of the square to the next, so that you're creating the circulating pattern, that's important. It can be polarized or unpolarized light that's doing that. So it's still just simply the circulation of the beam of light that's important. And
Does it make any difference whether it's going counterclockwise or clockwise, right?
Oh, it does. It does make a difference. If it's going clockwise, if it's circulating clockwise, then the space is actually going to be twisted in a clockwise direction. And if the light is going counterclockwise, then the space is actually going to be twisted in a counterclockwise direction. But the up and down vibration of the light isn't going to affect anything.
But
the direction of the light, the way it's actually moving from one mirror to another, that is going to be affected. And so if it's going in a circulating, if it's going clockwise, then the space is going to be twisted that way.
So you selected a polarized beam, which is basically straight up and down sine waves, like a knife edge, going down the center of this twisting.
Going from one edge of the square to the mirror, hitting off that corner of the mirror. In other words, what you're doing is you're essentially just bouncing a light beam from one mirror to another mirror to another mirror to get the light beam to move around.
Okay.
Circulate. Okay. So that's what I did, as far as the calculation was concerned. And then what I was able to show directly from the calculation, was that this circulating light beam was causing the empty space around which the beam was to circulate. It actually was causing that empty space to get twisted around. And then what I did, once again, as I said, this was all by the equations, was that I showed that if you put a neutron in there, and you can actually do that mathematically, that the neutron would actually get dragged around by the empty space. And the effect is that the basic equation showed that the twisting of the neutron was actually due to two different things. One was the intensity of the light, that is the amount of energy. And the other was that it depended inversely on the size of the square. In other words, the smaller the square, the greater the twisting of the neutron. And so you can see what this meant. This meant that you would try to get as much energy into as small a region as possible, and that would increase the effect dramatically. So the actual size of the device, and that's why we're talking about not sending people, but sending subatomic particles and information, the actual size of the device would be about the width of a human hair.
I think we have a caller on the line. Caller,
yeah,
first name? And your first name?
My name is Tonoya.
How are you doing?
Hi.
I'm doing all right. I'm in a hotel, and it's cold outside, so I'm in a hotel, and I was on their internet. They have, like, these stations where you can go on the internet. I recorded it with my camcorder on my phone, and you were talking about this thing, superfluid, right?
Right.
Universe, I just want to hear, have you ever heard of the word gravistar?
Gravistar?
Yes.
No, if it's referring to gravity of a star, but what's a gravistar?
It's an actual, summary of what the universe really is. It says it's an argon atom, and time and space is superfluid.
Well, I mean, the thing is that space and time does act like a fluid. That's right. And that's one of the bases on which my work is based, is to utilize that fluid property of space, to use that, to show that, or use a circulating light beam to cause the space to become twisted around, like, and it behaves like a fluid in that regard.
Okay. I heard about the trampoline and the bowling ball. You say the thing I'm trying to figure out, do you need to have an actual machine to do time travel, or can you do it with your mind?
No, as far as we know, you would have to have a device of some sort in order to do it. The thing is that because what we're talking about is the physical basis of doing it, you would actually have to have some sort of a device that's actually either based on using matter or using energy. I suppose if you thought about the fact that your brain waves create some sort of electromagnetic disturbance, in some sense, your brain waves do affect space-time. But they don't have the intensity enough to affect it directly that, that we've been able to measure, that would allow this curvature of space to occur, that would allow time travel.
Some people are more intense than others.
Go ahead. I've already discovered by researching a lot of things on the internet that really spirituality and science are one and the same, and that's the truth.
Well, they could be. I can tell you a lot of scientists that think they're high priests of science.
Oh, my gosh. When I think of what you just said, I think of Rush 2112. If you heard that entire album, that thing is really on point. It's so awesome. I love Rush.
Oh, no doubt about it. I always thought they needed to finish
you're
long,
on BBS, right?
I beg your pardon?
You're on X2 Radio, or are you on BBS?
I'm on both. We stream from x2-radio.com through the BBS Radio studios in Paradise, California, and we're also streaming live on the Steel Eye Radio Network.
Steel Eye, I like that. Well, I'm trying to figure out, because X2 Radio is Brooks Agnew. I've already emailed him, and he's doing that expedition to the Hollow Earth, and I really want to go. Bad.
Yes. Yes, we are trying to do that. We're targeting next summer, and you know we're in the same mode as everybody else. So we're working very hard on a very neat scientific expedition to try to learn something and make a direct observation. And if you really want to apply, then you need to go to the Phoenix Science Foundation. That's phoenixsciencefoundation.org, and then click on the APEX link. And that APEX link will tell you all about the expedition, and there is a free application on there. All you need to do is answer 6 questions, and
you know
email
what?
I already read it.
You're right. I already read it, and I emailed him back saying that, you know, I like those questions. They're awesome, and the fact that he doesn't even want any fee to go there. He just wants you to know if you're that conscious, that aware, and that you will be an actual factor to make this thing occur. And I love that.
Yeah, well, he is me.
That's awesome.
I'm Brooks Agnew, so I do refer to myself.
I thought you were Mallet. I thought you were Mallet. Okay, yeah. Nope. I emailed you about a month ago.
Oh, well, I got it, I'm sure. And it is difficult to tell the difference between Ronald and me, but that's okay. And we really like your observations, too, because this fluidity of space is something that's a really neat observation. I had another person who was talking about a time machine that they had built out of water. They were stressing water, and they were twisting it with these high-speed impellers, creating all kinds of cavitation. And after burning up 3 electric motors, they finally got the thing to make a watch change time, which I thought was really, really impressive. Ronald's technology is much more like the physics that I understand, and it makes a lot of sense to me. And we're talking about the theory of how to make a neutron drag around by spinning space with a laser. What do you think about that?
I'm thinking quantum physical all the way. It's all quantum physics, man. Quantum mechanics and quantum physics is how we can do time travel.
Well, there you go.
It's got to be that way. it's kind of weird how quantum physics is not even in science books because of the fact that it's all like, you know, people that believe in quantum physics, scientists know it exists, but they don't want to go into that realm. It doesn't make sense to, why wouldn't they? Are they that not curious or something?
No, it's because the math is intimidating. Come on. I mean, look at Einstein. He ran to the end of known physics. How long, Ronald, did he have to study with that mathematician in Hamburg until he finally figured out how to write the equations he wanted to write?
Well, it took him 10 years. After he developed the special theory of relativity in 1905. But in order to go that next step to show that gravity was the curvature of space, he needed the help of a mathematician named Marcel Grossman. And that, in order to understand the mathematics, which is technically called tensor calculus, it required him an additional 10 years. So it wasn't until 1915 that he was able to develop his general theory of relativity.
Now, Einstein was a pretty smart guy. If it took him 10 years, then now we know why most scientists don't believe in quantum physics, because they just don't spend the time to learn the math.
Right. Well, whatever happened
to
Tesla?
Yeah, well, the thing is that physicists, they understand, I mean, physicists actually believe in quantum physics. What they don't have, what they have a hard time is interpreting what it means. In other words, you can use it as a tool, but to understand what it's really saying is very difficult. And in fact, Richard Feynman, who was actually a master of quantum physics, said that anyone who says that they completely understand quantum physics hasn't really understood it. And the thing is that it's just trying to interpret what it really means in our world. I mean, we were talking about observation and how we influence, how our observations influence reality. That's one of the aspects that's still not completely understood in terms of quantum physics. And so, to me, quantum physics is a truly beautiful theory, and it's one of the things that motivated me to actually become a theoretical physicist, in addition to Einstein's work. But we still don't completely understand all of its implications.
Great.
You know what I want to say right now? This is what I think reality really is. Two words. Illusionistic perspection.
Illusion and perspective?
Illusionistic perspective is what reality to me is.
Interesting.
You know, have you heard of the movie Matrix?
Yeah,
oh, yes,
yeah,
of course.
Okay, that's pretty much what we're about. But we're not going to be in this little pod feeding the robots. That's BS. That's entertainment. But
well,
in that aspect, though, you know,
the fact that you're listening to X Squared Radio means you're no longer part of the Matrix. You are now awake.
I love that movie. Keanu Reeves, yeah. I'm telling you, Keanu Reeves, his character in the movie, the one, you know, Neo.
Neo.
I'll tell you, there is no one. In reality, every single thing, matter or energy, is all one and the same. We all have the potential to be just like Neo.
All right, that's exactly right. Well, listen, we have about
20 minutes. I'm going to let you go, yeah.
All right, my friend. Thank you very much for the call.
Well, you have a nice night. Thank you.
All right.
Bye.
Thanks for listening. Okay, so we're going to – now we have this spinning space-time. You have now twisted it up with your lasers, theoretically, and it's now – we've curved it. Now, are you going to send something down the center of this ring?
Well, the way in which we will actually know that the time loop has been formed – is one of these ways in which engineers and scientists like. It's one of these clear-cut things. One of the things that we know exists in nature are subatomic particles that can only live for a very short period of time, and they completely disintegrate. Unlike the electron lives forever, but there are particles, some of them are called muons and others are pions, but they only live for a millionth of a second. And they're like materials like that are radioactive. In other words, these they have a half-life. They completely disintegrate. Now, let's suppose that you have a beam of these short-lived particles, and you normally, if they say live for a millionth of a second, and you have a detector out there, then you have this beam of particles coming in. So statistically, they'll all decay in about a millionth of a second when they get to the detector. Now, if I have a time loop that's in that region just before the detector, then as you're sending this beam of particles in, some of the particles are going to be coming along one side of the loop. Some of them are going to be coming along the other side of the loop. As they move through the region where the time loop is, you can see what's going to happen. Their lifetime is going to be affected differently depending on where they've come through the loop. So that when you have the detector back there, then you'll actually see a difference, a change in their lifetime. And this would be one of those clean experiments that tell you that the short-lived particles have actually changed their life by having gone through the time loop. So that's the real type of initial experiment we'll do, is to change the lifetime of these short-lived particles by having them go through the region where the time loop is.
That sounds pretty quantitative. It does.
Right. As I said, whenever I've mentioned this at the technical discussions I've had with, as well as popular, you know, audiences, I mean, the engineers and the scientists, I mean, like it because it is one of those clear cut, as you say. It's a very, quantitative way of seeing that you have created a time loop. And so that's what we're actually going to be doing initially after we've shown that the neutron is dragged around. The second step will be to show that short-lived particles' lifetimes have been altered.
That sounds like a very fun project to be part of. I am currently tied up in eastern Washington State. I'm building a biodiesel plant. It's not an ordinary biodiesel plant. We're combining a couple of technologies, seed crushing of canola seed and high-speed reaction of the oil, the resulting oil, with methanol to create biodiesel in a continuous process. And it meant we had to invent some things because, as I said, this has never been done before in this manner. So we had to invent some ways to keep methanol clean and make sure we didn't end up with a whole bunch of work in process. And so we're now putting that together. And fortunately, it's driven by the high price of oil. So it's coming together very, very quickly. In about 3 months, we're going to be done with this project up here, cranking out 16 million gallons of biodiesel a year, which is clean burning and self-lubricating, and it's kind of nice. People like it in their diesel engines. So, but your project just completely fascinates me. I can just imagine lasers stacked up and putting a few joules through a few lasers and watching how it's opened up. And you know it's going to go down in history, which means someone in the future is going to read about it and say, well, I'm going to build the transmitter to go back to that receiver, and you're going to start getting a steady stream of information from the future. And then we're on a different path, my friend.
Oh, yeah. That would be wonderful. That would be wonderful.
Well, I think it's going to happen. It's not that I'm a prophet or anything, but this kind of thing is going to be on this program, you know, forever. We'll keep the website live forever, and they'll have access to it forever. And once word gets out, and we sent this out, your appearance on this program, in our email newsletter, which goes out to several thousand people who subscribe to our free newsletter, and we encourage anyone who comes or who's listening live, please sign up for the newsletter, and we'll send you any kind of breakthroughs that come about this project. And I want to let you know, his book, Dr. Ronald Mallett, his book is Time Traveler. It's an easy read. It's not one of those 2,000-page books. It's a couple hundred pages, very easy to understand, very touching analysis and discovery. And I'm sure there's more to come from you. So what are you working on now besides appearing on radio programs and book signings, and I'm sure you're selling millions of books, at least you're gonna now that you've been on this program. What's happening with Ronald Mallett? How's it going?
Well, what I'm doing is working out the amount of time that a short-lived particle will actually live by going through the loops. I mean, in other words, that's the phase that I'm at right now is going through the calculations of looking at how these, they're called unstable particles, but how the lifetime of these unstable particles is affected by the loops. And I have some people who are interested. There's a cosmic ray experimenter at Florida A&M who's interested in verifying my work. And there's an Italian scientist who's interested. So that's what I'm presently focusing my attention on. And I am a full-time faculty member. So, right. So, in fact, one of the things that I'm spending this weekend doing is grading final exams. So, right. In other words, so that's part of my regular activity.
Oh my gosh, that's fantastic. Well, I just want to build the darn thing. I mean, I'm a hands-on solution kind of physicist. After getting through the classes, and I financed my way through college by building things and solving problems. So I've been a contractor for almost 10 years, doing what you were doing at United, just solving problems for various companies. And now I own part of this one, so I'm really dedicated to it, and I enjoy it. I'm excited to have you on the program, and it's been. Is there anything about your technology we have not covered that you want to cover?
No, I mean pretty much. I think that people will, the book is both, as you mentioned, it's a popular level book for the general public, and it's also a memoir. It tells people the process. It tells, it's actually an autobiography as well as a popular science book, so people will get a notion of exactly what's involved in my life and how that evolved, and also get, and you were talking about the Sitter space and about, the expanding universe and wormholes. All of these other things are discussed in the book as well, so I think that people will get a very good idea of what's necessary to actually think in terms of the possibilities of a real time machine. I think one of the things that people also need to be aware of, because of the fact that time travel is going to happen, as I said, we were already seeing of it in terms of fractions of a second into the future with the experiments that were done using ordinary planes with atomic clocks, that it's only a matter of time that we have the breakthroughs that are necessary to allow us to travel not only into the future but into the past. We need to keep in mind that we don't want this technology to be abused. And I think that this is another reason why people need to be kept in touch with exactly how fast the technology is accelerating, because they will wake up one day. And if they're not aware of the fact that it's going to be a possibility, it's going to happen. And we have to have regulations. So even when time travel does happen as a practicality, people will have to say, this is how we want the technology to be utilized. It needs to be regulated by the public, not by the military. And another movie that's one of my favorites is Time Cop. I don't know whether you've seen it or not.
Oh, yeah. That's the one with Van Damme in it.
That's right, Claude Van Damme, and he plays a time enforcement officer.
Right.
And one of the things I really liked about that movie is the fact that it addresses the fact that once we have this, it can be abused, and we will need something like a time travel enforcement agency to monitor how it's utilized. And in that particular movie, there were examples of how it could be misused. I thought it was very, very well done. So that's something that I think the public needs to keep in mind.
Contemplating something with lottery numbers, but don't let anyone know.
Yes, well, that's the other problem, is the fact that it's very easy to see how one might utilize it, and it's going to, as I said. However, it's not an easy technology. It's not something that you're going to be able to go into the store and get like you can get a new PC or something like that. So.
There's another very clever movie that came out last year, and I'd say three quarters of the movie was clever, and then it fell into just plain old Hollywood stuff, and that was a movie called Next with Nicholas.
Yes.
See 2 minutes into his own future and how it affected him. Now that made a lot of sense, but then it got kind of crazy at the end of the movie. But the first part of it was pretty neat, how he was using that to survive. Anyway, the subject of time travel is extremely popular, and I know that you're going to do well with it. We're going to be watching closely and listening. And, of course, when you make your breakthrough, you're automatically invited to call me up
email me, let me know that you're ready to make a quick announcement, and we'll break in live any Sunday evening between 5 and 8 p.m. Pacific, and we'll make an announcement globally that that we've made a breakthrough. We're all about sunshine here, so if we keep as much sunshine on this project as possible, then it will be used for the good of mankind.
Well, thank you, Brooks, and I really appreciate the opportunity to discuss this with you and your listeners. And as I said, I invite them to contact me, and I should mention that my email address, you mentioned my website, but my email address is rlmallett@aol.com. And so listeners are free to visit me there. And I should mention that the book is out in paperback as well. It's just recently been released in paperback.
Oh, that's great. That's great. That makes it really affordable. And it is available at Amazon.com, and, of course, you can get it at Barnes & Noble and Borders and Walden Books and all of that. That's a really good way to help the project go out and buy a million copies of this book, and let's get the funding in place. And if you aren't a big reader but you want to see the research go forward anyway, go to Ronald's website. It's at www.physics.ucon, that's UConn.edu, and there'll be information on there for how you can contribute funds to help this happen. $250,000, we ought to be able to raise that by Wednesday, folks, so let's get going on it. Ronald, it's been a pleasure having you on the program. Absolute pleasure. I love talking about the subject, and I love talking about it with someone who's doing something with it. And you are a rare scientist, and it's my pleasure. I might be more more happy or more elated talking to Einstein, but since that doesn't exist yet, you're going to have to do.
Thank you very much, Brooks.
Oh, this is fantastic. I just love having you on the program. So, wait, I got one more question from an IMer. Hold on a second. Let me see
sure.
if I can read it. Oh, we already talked about that question. He must have been sleeping. He was talking about the granddaughter. Yeah, it is a three-hour program, and people blink in and blink out, kind of like electrons do in this universe. So, Ronald, have a fantastic week, and don't make any mistakes grading those papers.
I won't, Brooks. Thank you very much.
I used to get at least a letter grade higher by going in and arguing with the professor after every single exam, trying to explain to him what I really meant by that long answer, and I just needed to put that minus sign there, and it would all fit together.
Right.
Have a wonderful week.
You too, Brooks. Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Good night.
All right, my friends, Earth Explorers, that was Dr. Ronald Mallett. His book is Time Travel. And we'll let you get back to your week, my friends. If you're tuning in on Monday or Tuesday or some other evening of the week to listen to the archives, just remember, we're listening and we'll be around. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.